you want to start us off with introductions?
Sure. I'm Michael Torres, Clark County staff.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Doug Goff, City Council member from La Center.
Janet, Clark County.
Adam Kravitz, community member.
Lydia, y'all know me.
I'm Tom. I'm from Sayre and also from Hands Across the Bridge.
Yes. And welcome. You've worked with
us.
So excited. Awesome.
Thank
and Bridget,
you,
we're just doing introductions, and so if you want to take over.
I apologize. I thought it was on ADA. Oh, I'm Bridget McClayman. And
Rebecca Rice.
Welcome, everybody.
Rebecca Rice, Clark County staff.
Bridget, do we want everyone back here? So.
That would be Rebecca.
Everybody want to introduce themselves? Not all of them.
Dennis Harrell, JMSU program. Scott Knacker, JMSU.
Diane Hyde, director for Columbia River Mental Health.
I'll motion to approve.
Second.
All those in favor? Against? Abstention? Motion. Minutes are adopted. I'm going to hand it over to you, Rebecca.
Okay. So now it's time to do our community action program RSA application presentation. So this will be the same format that we did at the March meeting for the homeless crisis response system, where they presenters have 5 minutes to present their information, and then 5 minutes for questions and answers. Some have brought PowerPoints or other materials for you to review, and I'll hand those out when they come up and to present. So our first presenter this morning is Columbia River Mental Health, and since they're here, we can go ahead and start.
Can
we stop
here?
Yes, please.
No.
Services include assessment, goal setting, identifying supports, identifying barriers and steps to overcome those barriers, positive life coaching and counseling, resume and cover letter help, job search assistance, referrals to resources to enhance skills, interview practice, reaching out to employers, and representing our clients and educating them on people with disabilities and how to help employ them. Introducing the clients to the employers, getting job ready for job starts, helping to get haircuts, showers, helping to get clothing. We help with job retention and career progression opportunities. We accompany our clients to various employment sites, community resources such as Human Services Council, Like to Work programs, ones of that nature. Utilizing support funds for necessities such as ID cards, tools, boots, food handlers, cards, glasses, classes, etc. In 2008, we helped 57 participants get 44 community jobs. We have always exceeded the participant job start goals for every year. The program staff includes us. This is our staff right here. Two employment specialists and a supervisor, and we're part-time employment specialists. We work one-on-one with our participants, providing job readiness and job searches, interview training, interview readiness, resumes, transportation, community resource links, job retention services, education, and training resources. Many folks come to us from individualized support after not getting what they needed successfully in the classroom setting. We send out job leads packets to 350 recipients each week or anybody in the community who needs it, as well as social service agencies and clients. We receive the Hope in Action Award for contribution to the community for this. We're involved in the Point in Time Count, Project Homeless Connect, along with multiple other marketing opportunities. We collaborate with 18-plus community agencies for our clients on a monthly, weekly, or daily basis, attending employment specialists, collaboration meetings, staying up to date on best practices for employment specialists to follow, and continually updating our database and resources in the area. We know where to send our people when they need help because we're connected to this population. We utilize our own vehicles with our clients, giving them a more direct access to potential employers, job fairs, employment services, ID documentation, typically within a two-week period of our intensive in-person supports, have completed the initial assessment, created a resume, initiated job readiness, overcome barriers, and we have our clients applying for jobs and meeting face-to-face with potential employers. So we'll get them going as fast as we can.
And we try and build confidence by making sure our clients are prepared and letting them know what to expect in an interview setting. This gives them a sense of empowerment and confidence and enables them to perform well. We meet our clients where they are at with a mindset that each individual is not a cookie-cutter candidate. We seek to understand rather than to be understood.
A satisfaction survey about our services completed by our clients and turned in annually. In 2018, the survey showed 3.93 out of a possible 4 for satisfaction. Our grievance forms are part of our initial assessment. We explain the process at that time. To date, we have never had a grievance form submitted.
We really do make a positive impact on people's lives, people who would otherwise not get what they need to be successful, get a job.
And we hope that you choose to continue to support our valuable program. It's helped a lot of people in this area. And I don't know how some of these people would be served if we weren't out there helping. So thank you.
No questions? We have 5 minutes for that.
So I have a question. Are many of the clients, they all come through the Housing Solution Center, but are many of the clients also CRMH?
There's all of the places on the handout that we passed out. We go out and do orientations with the clients at those places. We have them kind of set up on a certain day of the month and hold orientation to our services. So we are, at least 15 sites where we're doing orientations.
And we meet them on the street and the service. You know, if we go to soup kitchens or places like that, we meet our clients there. And we're specifically working with people with disabilities, so
referrals
from all the other agencies
and other clients that we have.
When you said that you exceeded your goals, could you say what those numbers? What were the goals and what your actual outcomes were?
So for 2018, just the 4 quarters, the goal was to help people, 25 people become employed. That's what was in our contract, and we helped 37 people to get 44 jobs. Sometimes it takes more than one job for someone to find a niche that's going to be accommodating. job that will not, you know, cause them more stress. And so we definitely, that's what, seven people that we helped to get two jobs in the last year.
Well, do you track their stability once they're in a job? Like how long they stay in a job? Is it
the HMIS system is what we report to, and a lot of people are on the HMIS system, and it gives tracking for 30, 60, 90, 120 days. There's way to count that in our reports. And
do you know what your averages are in terms of, you know, people being able to stay in a job?
The retention part of
yeah.
it? I can't remember the exact numbers for last year, but quite a few people made it to 120 days and passed. And a lot of times, they get a job and then you never hear from them again.
They don't need it anymore, so
you know,
several months go by.
But we try to keep up with them.
And those that don't come back to us anyway, and then we try and get another, not likely to disappear at the times they come back, and we'll help again.
Can I ask a question, too? How much of your guys' time, just roughly, give or take, do you feel like you spend filling up forms, dotting I's, crossing T's, and how much of your time do you spend actually serving somebody?
We spend most of our time servicing the clients.
Okay.
I mean, there's paperwork and everything
sure.
we do, and
yeah.
you know, getting that right helps us, you know, along the way. But you know, if we're not working directly with the client in our vehicle, taking them to job, then we're out there meeting employers. You know, we're going out there and I get in people's business in the area, find out how to get them hired.
And then also, do you provide any support for them once they get that job?
Oh, by all means.
Okay.
You know, they call us. We try to set it up in the beginning if, you know, we're available for them to call or to walk off a job or just call us, you know. We'll come down, we'll talk with you and the employer. We want job retention to happen. We try to keep that going.
Okay.
So if they need something like
work groups
or something, if they're in a job, you know, or like if they're in a kitchen and they need non-slip shoes, they'll come to us and we can help with that sort of thing too.
How do you help someone who might have a standard of their, I mean, I'm not saying this to be mean in any way, but their standard of work might be lower than an employer wants it to be. So, like, coming in on time and being prepared to work and those kinds of things. How do you help them raise that standard for themselves a little bit so they can keep that job?
They look at what we're doing and how we're showing them and
mm-hmm.
what we're teaching them to do along the way is
mm-hmm.
is kind of overcoming those barriers in the beginning and finding out what they are through communication. You know, a lot of times you can't get that in other settings, but when you're in the vehicle with somebody, you're sitting there right around, you know who they are, they're human beings,
right.
they have their faults, you know,
sure.
and you try to work through that as you go along, I guess.
So it's a lot of it is about building the relationship that you have.
Absolutely, which we can do with a one-on-one setting like that.
Awesome.
Can you clarify the difference between Clearview and the Hope Change program?
Sure. So Columbia River Mental Health Services is our parent company. Clearview is the employment arm, and there are several employment programs within Clearview. The other ones are serving clients of Columbia River Mental Health. Hope Change is one of the programs within Clearview, but we don't serve Columbia River Mental Health clients because they have services available from the other programs that are at Columbia River. So we serve all of the folks in the community with disabilities who are low income that are kind of listed out here.
And we are funded.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Janice Hughes.
Thank you. the need was so high. We knew that there was a lot of great programs in the community, such as Next or Workforce or Pitt or Clark College. But the problem was the connection with those resources. Youth would not access the resources. There's a trust issue with adults, and there's a distrust in the need. As Janice had created this trust with the youth, and they trust us to connect with them. And so what this program does is take them to these resources that are already there with a warm handoff. And we had no idea the need for this service. A lot of the youth that we would house or the youth that we work with at our drop-in center wouldn't go to these resources, and they were always there, but they never accessed them. And then we started this program 3 years ago and realized that just having somebody take them there and explaining how to, you know, speak with people and how to fill out a resume and how to do all these things that as adults now we find in Second Nation, but when you're a youth, it's scary to make these connections. So this program is Worksource, is Jobs First Navigator, helps them either get employment or education, and connects them with the resources that are already out there. We had great success with this program. We helped 30 youth last year. We had 6 youth enroll in school, and we had 20 find employment. I know that's not the all 30, but some of them fall off the radar, so that's just how it is. But having them connect to the resources that are already out there has been profound in their success in getting off the streets and staying housed and getting into housing. So having that sort of sense of accomplishment of getting involved in the community has really been probably successful.
I think you're aware of, you didn't specify, because these youth are all homeless youth. So we're talking about youth that have no place to live. Last year, our outreach teams that we have made almost 1,000 contacts with homeless youth in Clark County. So it's a youth issue. And our goal, basically, the goal of all of these programs, this links with our housing program. So we have youth in apartments. We're providing case management support, but they aren't going to be able to maintain the apartments if they don't have a job. So this is really a linchpin to our long-term goal of preventing adult homelessness. We brought you some charts last time. I didn't repeat those, but just to take you back, if we can get one single youth off of the street and not age into adult homelessness, we're looking at a $2 to $2.5 million savings for the community in terms of lifetime support that kid is going to require. So when we talk about 20 youth or 30 youth, that's a lot of return on investment to the community. But our goal, again, the youth, we have programs, we have outreach to bring them into the drop-in, we have housing programs to get them into apartments, but they aren't going to be able to maintain them if they can't be employed. And that's what we found out, was this is kind of magic.
culture they call us and help them out. But you know, we're not here to keep them in the program for their life. So if they don't contact us, that's a success for them, maybe we're self-sufficient. So they, a lot of them do come back to success.
And somebody's asked about repeats. A core value of Janus as an agency for all of our programs is we describe it as once a Janus youth, always a Janus youth. So sometimes we'll have a youth that might be 2 or 3 years out, and they might come back and say, look at what I've done. They also might come back and say, wow, I just did a bump, I lost my job, I'm going to lose my apartment. It doesn't make a difference if they're a youth anymore or not. But in that program, they know they can always come back and access that service. I also think it's really telling that many of the youth that we end up with in these programs are referred by other youth on the street who have been in the service before. And that's actually one of our primary referral networks is not organizations, but it's actually youth on the street that are saying, this is a place you should go to help. And that's something I think I get very excited about.
You guys mentioned that with you specifically, that part of the issue is with trusting adults, right?
Mm-hmm.
That makes total sense. Is there also, I'm trying to figure out how to ask this. Do they need support around self-esteem, self-efficacy, or is it more around having a support system and having people that can help build them up a little bit? To
I
believe
think
it's
the network that creates the self-esteem. You know,
mm-hmm.
Once they start achieving things and reaching their goals, they set their own goals and they start achieving it, and then the self-esteem grows. And having that support network when you're scared and out there on the streets, having people that you can turn to talk to, discuss problems.
Mm-hmm.
Self-esteem comes after that. It just grows naturally, so the confidence grows through experience.
So again, it's back to relationships.
Yeah,
definitely.
Are you familiar with the ACEs research? It's called the
Adverse Childhood
Experience. People have heard of those. So if you have more than 4 ACEs, your likelihood of everything from suicide to jail goes off the charts. We did a survey in Oregon of homeless youth in the Portland area, and we found out that over 75% of our homeless youth have more than 4 ACEs coming in. Mm-hmm. So the trauma they're bringing in is huge, and part of the rebuilding the trust is our core model that we operate from, evidence-based practice, is positive youth development. So we don't see the youth as problems in need of help. We see them as they have strength to be able to solve their problems, and we can support them. I think it's that attitude, not just the support, but it's the attitude of staff and working with them. That's part of what helps build that trust, is we're not saying, oh, this is the client. It's like, oh, how can we help you? And we think you have the ability to do that, but we're the support for helping you really achieve your goals.
Any last questions?
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you
very much.
Our next presenter is Lifeline Connections for their employment support for individuals in the government. $45,000 to help unemployed individuals who have behavioral health disorders find and secure competitive employment. The county funds will cover 0.25 FTE employment threshold to work directly with clients and employers and to provide critical individual supports. The request leverages funding provided by Washington State Medicaid to create a full-time position. People with behavioral health disorders experience profound and unique barriers to employment. We're pleased to launch Individual Placement Services, which is an evidence-based employment program that's proven over the past 20 years to significantly improve the employment for these folks. We serve
serve more than 4,000 people a year. 90% of them are low income or very low income. Many have been homeless or unemployed or both for many years. We started this program because traditional employment services don't adequately address some of the unique barriers that this population has. This screen shows why supportive employment is really important for our clients. When most of us change jobs, we have sort of a personal infrastructure that we use that helps make it happen. What if you lost important documents because you've been living on the streets, or you left a domestic violence situation in the middle of the night? Would you have $175 to replace your birth certificate, your ID, your record of work history, and get a food handler's card just so you could even apply for a basic food service job? What if you needed a GED, or reliable transportation, or glasses, or a haircut, or dentures so you'd be presentable? These are the kinds of adjunct services from this grant that we'll provide for these clients. Because we build trusting relationships with the clients who seek us for treatment, Lifeline is able to address the issue of employment for our clients from physician coordinated integrated care. We work closely with others in the community, such as WorkSource and DSHS, to ensure that all available resources are effectively utilized by our clients. Support continues as long as clients need assistance, and again, if they need it more than once. It's a new program at Lifeline. We just opened this fall, but research is pretty compelling about the effectiveness of individual placement services like this. One analysis found that 58% of supported employment clients achieve competitive employment at some point over 12 to 18 months, compared with 21% that we showed earlier. And we expect to see similar or better results in our program. Our programming is shaped by our clients' needs. Client feedback is solicited through comment cards available in our lobbies, and client surveys are completed at least annually. Staff at all levels of the agency are trained in accepting grievances from clients, and our quality assurance specialist is mandated to respond within 24 hours. Our approach is client-led. It's client-driven. Everything we do from our opening assessment through our clinical work and into our recovery supports, of which this is one of them, is really led and determined by what the client wants. And with our guidance and our ability to help open doors, they're able to really reach their goal for recovery and self-sufficiency. We're happy to answer any questions you may have. These are the contact folks.
So, those who experience substance abuse issues often come with unique barriers, as you mentioned. So, have you thought about how you might help them address some of those barriers, such as legal barriers? Maybe is that something that would be included in your curriculum?
So, I think that because our folks are with us from the beginning of treatment, the initial assessment that we take with folks looks at a lot of different domains of their life. What's your housing? What's your mental health? What's your substance use history? What's your physical health? What are your legal issues? What are your transportation issues? Do you need child care? So from the first time we talk with them, we've got this picture of what their needs are. And throughout treatment, those needs are constantly looked at. So they do carry over when we're in that employment setting with them. We say, all right, how are you working on? How are these going?
Are you only serving clients of like people that are in treatment with Lifeline?
Good question.
Yes, at this time. We would like to open it up to external referrals if we had the capacity to serve.
But this proposal is for clients of Lifeline. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can you explain, so we can't, these funds can't be used for Medicaid eligible services, so can you kind of explain what would be paid for with this funds versus what would be paid for with the Medicaid eligible funds?
Can you talk to the sort of the wait list, the life of the people who are coming to us that want to help?
So we've had a few times where somebody who's not Medicaid eligible or isn't eligible for FCS coverage through AmeriGroup, we've been able to work with them as best as we can, but if we're not using that funding, we can't really do much for them. And the Medicaid funding also doesn't cover those additional supports like getting their GED, helping them with transportation. So there's no money available for those kind of out-of-pocket costs.
mainly what's on the slide that talks about the extending support would be
yes.
paid for, and that's not Medicaid eligible.
No.
The total numbers that were served last year?
We're brand new.
Oh, this is
brand new. In the
okay.
employment program.
Got it. Okay.
So when did we, I think our first client started January?
September.
Oh, September. Okay.
Okay. So how many have been served since then?
I've been the
roughly.
Only part-time employment specialist to be able to serve, and my capacity was 10 clients, and
mm-hmm.
I've been serving about 13.
Okay.
Our wait list is up in the 80s now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So these funds can, we have some funds that can only serve up to 125% of the federal poverty level, and limited funds that can go up to 200% of the federal poverty level. The people that you have on the wait list that you were hoping to get into this program, would they need that 125% federal poverty level income restriction?
That's the expectation, but I think that is that.
In the hope to expand the program to where you can have serve more clients, right?
And as Rick pointed out, those clients that we can't serve because our existing funding is for Medicaid only.
So what sort of employer outreach do you manage to part-time with Medicaid clients?
It is, and our IPS supported employment model requires 6 employer contacts per week on behalf of our caseload. So sometimes that's not enough, and we can do more than 6, but that would be our minimum. And we do track that on a weekly basis and follow up with those employers as well.
And do you, if you place somebody
Yes, we do. We go from a job search plan to what we call a follow-along plan, documenting the services and supports that the person and the employer have requested to make a win-win job retention long-term position. And also, I wanted to mention that if it should not work out with that particular job, we do help the person back into the job search plan and look for a better.
Any last questions? Thank you. Thank you. Just so you guys know how we're doing it, if the organization finishes their presentation a little bit earlier than 5 minutes, I just let that run out, and then we start the 5 minutes of questions, so you get, like, whatever, you know, we're not cutting them short if they finish earlier. You're just getting more question time.
6 minutes
for questions. Got to take it when you can.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I thought we were
8:40 is what I have you for. Are you ready?
Very closely with these community partners. We talk about their clients.
nitty-gritty with the client to figure out what is it that we can help them with. We're really good at building their skills and getting those community connections. And so some of the impact that we've had in the past 12 months is we've helped 266 people gain employment, and that's through those skills that we can provide at Partners in Careers through the Career Academy program, such as building your resume, doing that one-on-one interviewing, helping them build that self-confidence piece that so many of these individuals that we're working with just don't quite have yet. We provide workshops that are held at all of our community partner sites, some of those partner sites you just saw on the slide previous. 97 people formerly unemployed secure jobs. That is huge. So we bring them into Partners in Careers, we go out to community agencies, and we're working with them in a cohort model or one-on-one. 254 people that came to us were facing barriers to employment. And a lot of the barriers are mental health. Maybe they're lacking childcare. Maybe it's transportation. Maybe it's substance abuse. But we're working through those barriers, and again, we're building those confidence. We're teaching them those skills. So what is it to create a resume? What do you have to offer? We all have something to offer, so we're giving them that hope. 234 of those individuals participated in a community service project with a partner agency.
So, what's working with Career Academy? I like to call it the workshop on wheels. Like I said, I can go out in the community, I can meet with people where they're comfortable and where they really need help. So we take out that barrier of, oh, how am I going to get there? What am I going to do with my kids? I've taught classes with a baby on my lap or done a resume with somebody with kids on my lap, right, to help them. We have those 40 community partners that we can refer our clients to. So we're the specialists for employment, but a lot of them do come with those extra barriers, right? We deal with folks dealing with homelessness, substance abuse, mental health issues. Sometimes there's language barriers too. So we have those 40 partners that we can reach out to and connect our clients with them as well. One-on-one support is huge for us. So typically someone starts off and they do 6 hours worth of workshops. You can see on the agenda the curriculum and what I go over in those workshops. And then after we set up one-on-one appointments with them, we get to know our clients really, really well, and we help them with exactly what they need help with. Okay. So we get them employed. If they're struggling, we're still there to help them. Okay. We're always there. Diverse communities. Like I said, we work with diverse populations. So anybody who has significant barriers can come in and get help.
Okay, so I talked a little bit about this, but it all begins within here, with the individuals that we help reach self-sufficiency at Partners in Careers. And it begins with building their confidence, their self-esteem, so that they're able to sit down in a computer and build that resume or go into an employer and have an interview, a successful interview that they're feeling good about themselves. So we always ask this feedback, how are we doing? That's really important. We want to make sure we're building that relationship and we're doing what we need to help them reach those goals. And so a lot of things that we hear is, you're giving me that self-confidence, you're giving me that self-esteem. It's a safe environment, it's that cohort model. So I'm coming in and I'm realizing that I'm not alone in this. That the people I'm sitting with in this room, they're walking that same path as I'm walking. And then they become aware of all those community connections. We have found that connecting them back to community helps them be that much more successful.
So one of our success stories was referred to us by the Department of Services for the Blind about a year ago. She was struggling finding employment. She was living with her sister's family and was at imminent risk of losing that housing because she couldn't provide financial support to her sister to stay there. We were able, within 3 months, we were able to get her employed. She got a job at Cloud One, and she hit her 180-day employment in March. She's still there. She's thriving. She still contacts us, talks to us about how she's doing. We talk about different struggles, and blindness is a significant barrier. So that's something we worked really hard with her one-on-one, so that she felt comfortable to go to an interview and to really know that she was employable and that somebody believed in her.
Thank you. And any questions?
So similar to the question I asked previously, so do you have in your curriculum, you talk about health and address barriers, do you have anything that specifically helps people to address criminal history? Because that seems to be a common barrier that I see. that may be varying taxes. It's important somebody could receive if they have credit.
So different kinds of things. A lot of it is self-confidence, how to talk about when you were in jail, talk about that period in your life positively in an interview. We also have, I have references for folks with different free legal services, and for immigrants as well, I have that form to give them. Folks that are legal immigrants still have legal issues that they're going through, so.
And then all of our employment specialists, we go through a lot of case management training, so we're learning constantly on how to have those conversations in regards to criminal history. How does that look from our side versus how's the client proceeding as we're asking those questions? So it's all about that relationship building that we really focus on our case management style.
Another thing is to make sure that we're not having them apply for jobs that they're not going to be able to get. You know, so we have a really serious talk with them and say, okay, if these are your convictions, I know you want to do this and this, but that's not going to be possible. So let's focus on what you can do.
So when you refer people to the agencies they need for other services, do you follow up with that agency to see they got there and see how they did or track the successful results?
So we do follow up all the time. I've actually gone to agencies and met with clients, especially if it's mental health issues. A lot of times they're really apprehensive about going to a different organization. I work really closely with the Val Ogden Center. I've met clients there. I've gone through their intakes with them because they're just not there yet. That's why I like the one-on-one piece too, because some folks that are dealing with high anxiety levels and other mental health issues are really nervous about coming to the workshop in a group setting. So my approach is, let's meet one-on-one. Get comfortable with me, get comfortable with the location that we're at, and then when you're ready, you can come to the workshops and participate in a group.
The other thing that Partners in Careers does is if you gain employment while you're in a program with us, we always give you have a lifetime guarantee. So you can come back to Partners in Careers at any time. You walk through our front doors and we will still serve you. We'll still help you. We'll still help you if you want to build your resume again or get interviewing skills or apply for different jobs. It's a lifetime guarantee.
I've literally had a client call me crying on a bus because we got her a great job, she loved it, her children got sick back-to-back weeks, and then she got sick and lost her job. Crying on a bus and saying, I have holes in my boots, my shoes are wet, and I'm like, okay, you're on the bus. Come back to PIC, come back to Partners in Careers, let's get you some boots. We have donated professional clothes closet. We'll get you some dry boots, and we'll just start over. Start where we're at.
Any last questions?
I mean, I see the work that you guys do because you come out to Battleground every other week, and I'm grateful for that. When you start to work with someone, what do you feel like the very first, what's the most common challenge that they need to overcome to move forward? The very first thing that you've got to identify for them?
I think it's that relationship piece. Mm-hmm. It is that relationship piece. A lot of times people don't want to open up because they've been judged so many times, right? Partners in Careers is different in that social service agency area because we don't. It's about building that relationship, building that trust. We're walking this path together. So it's that piece.
And we talk about what they can do. That's another thing. I think a lot of the people that we serve are focused on the past and the negative and what they can't do. Do all of these things. Let's just focus on that, right? Get excited about it.
We like to be that ray of sunshine in their life. Yeah. We want them to, whether we're going to them or they're coming to Partners in Careers, we want to be that light in their life.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Do we have anyone from Clark County Food Bank?
Thank you.
Sure.
from Clark County in 2013, receiving a 2-year contract for our program. Clark County Food Bank is seeking an additional $65,000 in funding to directly support the continued expansion of our Fresh Alliance program. Fresh Alliance is our grocery store recovery program, which collects and redistributes over 1.6 million pounds of nutrient-dense food each year to our community. This food is otherwise thrown away by the grocery stores and consists of high-quality, expensive food such as meat, produce, dairy, and eggs. Food is picked up and driven to CCFB, quickly unloaded and repacked into boxes with like items, all by volunteers. These boxes then get loaded into our inventory system, distributed to our partner agencies, and into the hands of hungry members of our community. Complying with national food safety standards and to avoid food waste due to spoil, we work quickly to provide same day pickup, repacking, and distribution of this food out to the community. Our largest supplier of fresh produce, Costco, joined the program in 2018, adding an additional 200,000 pounds of food to receive and distribute, which requires, of course, more volunteers, more staffing, and more truck usage, but this is an opportunity that we didn't want to miss. Fresh Alliance is directly managed by CCFB's full-time warehouse manager and supported by seven other warehouse employees. We rely heavily on volunteers for the operations of this program. However, given its growth over the last year, CCFB feels that we've hit our volunteer threshold. We don't currently have sufficient staffing to reliably execute this program without sacrificing elsewhere in our priorities. We've missed pickups at stores, resulting in reduced food intake and setbacks in our relationships with our donor stores. This is due to reliance upon unpredictable volunteer hours, who understandably travel, get sick, or take time off. The hours required to ensure Fresh Alliance functions smoothly far exceeds the resources at our current disposal. Since the program's inception in 2004, we've grown the network to include almost all grocery stores in Clark County, which is over 30 grocery stores. As we anticipate future program expansion, we also anticipate an increased need for additional resources, such as fuel, truck repairs, food bin, refrigeration, and of course, personnel time as well. Funding would allow staffing needs to be met, therefore allowing the program to grow and other warehouse operations to continue as usual. Funding would also allow CCFB to build partnerships with the last few remaining grocery stores in our county who are not part of the Fresh Alliance program. This will ultimately increase the amount of nutrient-dense food that we're able to get out to our community. Clark County Food Bank partners with over 40 community organizations, or as we refer to them, partner agencies, to provide a network of care for over 100,000 low-income individuals and families in Clark County. These partner agencies are strategically located throughout Clark County to best serve clients in all areas of our community. To ensure our food distribution services are utilized to best meet our clients, CCFB initiated a mapping project in 2017, allowing our staff and partner agency leaders to ensure that all low-income clients have equal access to food throughout the county. To specifically meet the needs of our clients, we first recognize that clients differ in backgrounds, ethnicities, cultural practices, and living situations. To best meet these needs, CCFB has actively recruited and gained access to volunteer translators or translating resources in both Spanish and Russian. Much of our nutrition education classes and materials are taught and printed in these languages to best serve our clients. CCFB strives to listen to the direct voice of our clients by incorporating individuals in leadership, as well as conducting surveys and testimonials. Our newly constructed Community Kitchens Food Pantry is solely operated by members of the Fruit Valley community, which is where the pantry is located. We also host a monthly meeting with all 40 of our partner agencies to discuss issues, goals, trainings, and ways to improve our services throughout the county. Additionally, we employ a part-time agency services coordinator to ensure that our partner agencies are in alignment with organizational policies, but also to ensure that our clients are treated equally and fairly.
Any questions?
What's your secret with volunteer success?
Secret with volunteer success? For this program specifically, we have over 500 volunteers that come and partner with us to do this. I think it's because it's something that everyone can relate to. food insecurity touches so many aspects of our community, and so our volunteers are people that have a direct experience with either food insecurity themselves, or might have family members or people in their neighborhoods that might also struggle with food insecurity. And so I think because it permeates our community so heavily, I mean, it's one in every four people in Clark County that struggle with food insecurity. So everyone knows someone that has that. And so I think our volunteers are passionate about solving that issue here in the community.
We rerouted, we changed our routes a bit. I'm the food donations coordinator there now. We changed our routes to make them shorter. They were originally 7:30 in the morning until about noon. And a lot of the volunteers who drive these trucks and go to these grocery stores and pick up these bins can be very, very heavy. They're usually retirees. And so thinking from the perspective of how do we retain these folks, we have to make it a little easier. There are folks who want to give their time, they don't want to give a whole day. So can we make it a shorter stint for them? So expanding our care for our volunteers, thinking about the lifts and how do we make it easier, how do we get staff to go out in trucks with them when we have enough staff. That's one of the reasons we're asking for your support. Makes a huge difference in whether a volunteer comes back to us. So trying to increase retention.
I have a question over here. I may have missed this in your narrative, but how many clients do you have on an average week?
We serve about 100,000 clients throughout Clark County. It fluctuates a little bit week to week. Typically towards the end of the month, the clientele increases, but that's about the number that we're working with at any given time. And that is through right now we have 42 partner agencies that we work with that directly distribute this food to clients. So we, as a food bank, gather all of the food and then get that out to the different partner agencies, and then they're the ones that have the direct interface with the clients.
Do you have a relationship with the North County Food Bank?
We do, yes.
Telegram?
Yes, so they get most of their food from the Clark County Food Bank.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
When you say 100,000 clients, are you, is that duplicated and duplicated in the space of a year? Or is it an estimate based on the pounds of food?
So we track all that data through our partner agencies. They're required to turn in specific numbers to us. So it is about 100,000 unduplicated clients throughout Clark County. But most of those are recurring clients that come back either weekly or monthly, just depending on the partner agency.
So do you also handle the commodities program?
Commodities program comes to the USDA, and you have to meet specific criteria, and there's actually a lot of paperwork associated with it, but it's a really great product, and we actually are working with the federal government now with tariff mitigation, so products that would have gone overseas in order to help farmers and ranchers and so on. The government has purchased that food, is funneling it through food banks, which is a really great haul for us, but it requires extra work for storage and transportation.
Fuel, truck repairs, additional refrigeration, and food bins to be able to, we've had just a massive increase in food that's coming in, or the opportunity to pick up food, and so it touches quite a few aspects of the program, the funding would, just because we would need personnel, but also in addition, just the amount of time that our trucks are going to be are spending on the road, our fuel costs have increased quite significantly, and then of course when you're running trucks all day every day, the repair costs and keeping that.
We had a 23-year-old truck, and I got pulled over by the troopers driving for the first time when I was the food warehouse manager, and it was deemed like unserviceable, like we couldn't use it. We did not know that. And so we were down three trucks, which meant a loss of food, a loss of pickups. We struggled and tried to find ways to make it happen. But it was the Edendall Lynch plant that stepped up and bought that truck that's actually outside right now for us. And that filled a tremendous gap. But again, we have another truck down right now, and so we're struggling. So this type of funding helps us.
79. It's served meals 365 days a year. We have two full-time staff there that manage the program, and the rest is all managed by volunteers. We serve between 75,000 and 90,000 meals per year there, and many of those people who are receiving services there are homeless, I would say 50 to 60%. The other percentage of clients that we serve there are low income, and they typically come in for meals towards the end of the month when their food stamps and other resources have been extinguished. There is also, under our Hunger Response Program, a Children's Initiative Program, and that includes our backpack program and our lunch program. The backpack program, we've increased it to include 25 fresh food pantries as well. So at 25 schools where they have space, we're able to put a fresh food pantry. And the reason that we prefer to do the fresh food pantries, and we've expanded to do as many of those as possible, is because they're less costly and because the quality of the food that the participants receive. They receive dairy, milk, cheese, butter, fresh meat, milk. It's a fresh fruit and vegetables. So it's a much better program than the backpack program, which obviously is very valuable and reaches a broader range of people, but it is done by volunteers that fill a backpack. It's actually just a recycled shopping bag. And those are distributed on Friday when the children go home from school, and it's to provide weekend food for them. So obviously it needs to be non-refrigerated. So it's packaged foods, but there's always a protein, a carbohydrate, fruit, vegetables. It's very nutrition-based, but it is still packaged food. We distribute about 1,640 of those bags every week, and all of that is done by one part-time staff member and a multitude of volunteers. We have between 40 and 50 volunteers that show up at our warehouse every Thursday to pack the bags and distribute them to the 93 schools that we're at. The flyer that I passed around said 92 schools, we've increased that to 93 now. Our focus is to reach out to the more rural areas and provide services in a bigger capacity there. So how will the program provide dignity and respect? So this program, especially the backpack program, we are very aware of the ethnicity and the culture of the children that we are reaching out to. And 34% of the students that are receiving our backpacks come from a Hispanic background. So we've increased the food to include rice, beans, salsa, foods that they're that's more favorable to them. We also do 44 hotel bags every week, and that is to serve clients that are staying in hotels and don't necessarily have a kitchen or the means to prepare food. So they'll have pop-up tops in the cans of fruit and vegetables, and their food that can easily be cooked in a microwave or not cooked at all. We also provide bags that are for children that have allergies, gluten-free bags, peanut-free bags are done in Vancouver School of Policy. We were very excited in the last meeting we were at with the Family Resource Center staff and the Vancouver Housing Authority administration staff, where they have now determined that food is not their number one priority outside of education because of the backpack program and the response that CHEER is able to provide to the students. Okay. How we collect satisfaction. We do surveys. It started with an evaluation by the Department of Health of our program, and they surveyed not only our parents and the clients that are receiving the food, but the teachers and then our staff and volunteers as well. And so we've continued that, and we take the results of that very seriously and implement changes in the following year. We've been very surprised in the beginning and then very proud of the fact that teachers consistently report that children, over 50 to 60% of the students are improving in areas like academic performance, attendance. socialization behavior. It makes such a big difference to have food, and they don't have to worry about being hungry and coming to school on Monday morning ready to do schoolwork instead of worrying about getting to that free lunch. It really does make an impact. And the hunger response program down at Share House, it's definitely one of our foundations, and we consistently listen to the clients. I get more you know how it is when you always hear from those that are complaining versus those that are happy. So I hear from those that say, you know, the fried chicken wasn't, you know, to my liking. I want a different breading or something like that. So it's really pretty minor, the concerns that we receive there. It mostly has to do with just different flavors, and we work in response to those.
Thank you.
I have a question. So we're trying to expand out in Battleground with the Share Backpack program. And our challenge out there, as you, I'm sure you've heard, is that there's a lot of pride. And I'm not going to take help from anybody, not to mention a program, because that feels weird. And we see it all the time with our unaccompanied youth, with our students, where we literally have to, like, beg them to take some help. Like, it's okay, kids, you can take this free coat, right? So can you think of other ways that we can help address that specific challenge of getting food into the homes of people who need it when they really don't want it to be seen by anybody else and they don't want to take help?
And that's a very common perception in the rural communities, is that they are less wanting to accept services. And I think it's just a matter of time and just consistency. What we found in our other schools is, I'll tell you one quick story. We had a woman who called us on Friday evening around 4 o'clock. Her child had come home from school with a backpack full of food. And she knew what it was because she knew of Share. And she called us, and she wasn't supposed to be a recipient. But her child at school was upset because the other children at school received it. And one of the little girls there handed her bag and said, "You can have mine." And her mom was terrified. I mean, she's like, now this child doesn't have food and I need to get it back. So it's just a matter of building that culture where it's not a negative to be receiving a bag, and where people want to receive them, it's going to take time. And definitely a lot of volunteers that are in the community that can promote it as well. This backpack program, Share as an agency, has over 3,000 volunteers a year. So we definitely utilize volunteers in a multitude of ways, and it's definitely presentations out in the community and getting the word out that this is available and that there's no stigma attached to it.
In that scenario, how do you screen for eligibility? Or is eligibility even a factor?
Eligibility is a factor, and it's screened at each of the schools. So we don't know the name of the students that are receiving it. We just receive the data on them, and the schools are the ones that do all of that screening and make sure that they're eligible.
Okay.
And
thank you.
So where do you get food?
Our partner. The agency that just presented Clark County Community Bank.
I didn't want us to.
No, they're a tremendous partner and a very valuable partner, and most of our food comes from there. We also purchase food when we don't have enough of a certain item, especially with the backpacks. We want to make sure that there's always a protein, there's always fruit and vegetables. So there are times when, and we do food drives. We'll have a multitude of food drives.
So I'm interested in the Share Meal program. With the opening of the navigation center, is that going to expand your food program services for?
I'm afraid not. That facility does not have the space. Well, it does have empty space, but the space that we lease from them does not have the ability to have a commercial kitchen. But we do provide food there. It's snack kind of food, and we have a donor who is a vending machine, so there'll be packaged sandwiches and things like that we distribute at that facility. We are talking about the navigation, the service center has only been open since November, so we're still trying to figure out how things should flow and what things are the best to do, but we're talking about potentially having they'll only come in the last week of the month because their service, their resources are extinguished.
So, quick question. I don't know if this is specifically for this program or other programs through SHARE, but kind of two questions. One is, and I ask this of so many of our organizations, how much of your staff time is spent doing data entry and dotting I's and crossing T's and filling out forms, and how much of it is spent building the relationships and providing the food and the services that SHARE has?
It really depends on the program. We have, at the From Home Service Center, we have volunteers who come in to do data entry. And so with the backpack program and the hunger response program, very little time is spent putting data in because it's done by a volunteer. Our case managers put their own case notes in, and they're spending more time putting data in because they're the ones that have to.
Do you feel like you're pretty nimble as far as technology changes and things that can help streamline processes a little bit?
That's one of our strategic goals for this year, is to improve. I mean, obviously, we participate in the countywide HMIS but we're expanding our, mainly to track our volunteers. That software, we've just improved our accounting software this year. So yes, technology is definitely a factor of our strategic goals.
Thank you.
We're running a couple minutes behind. Our next presenters are Clark College. And I just wanted to remind those that are presenting that Michael is our timekeeper, so keep an eye on him. He'll let you know when you have 1 minute remaining.
Good morning, my name is Armetta Burney. I'm from Clark College and I'm the Director of Workforce Education Services.
Good morning.
Good morning, I'm Katie Blakely. I'm the Director of Career Services at Clark College. I want to talk just a little bit about Clark College before we move forward into this. Probably all of you in the room know that it is the one affordable educational option for post-secondary education in the county. We have, I should know this off the top of my head, but I think it's about 80 programs at the college that we are supporting students into and through, and having them come back into the community as contributing members of the community and breaking the intergenerational cycle of poverty.
And 55% of our students are living in a household where their income is below 150% of the poverty level. And so we are in the process of redesigning all of our programs to ensure that we are meeting students where they are. So previously, our philosophy was to make sure our students were ready for us, but we are transforming the way in which we serve students. And so we want our students to know that however you come to us, we are going to make sure that we're providing the necessary supports to you to help ensure your success.
So to that end, I want to talk a little bit about the financial wellness program at Clark. A few years ago, we were recipients of grant funding that allowed us to build some programs that were intentionally interconnected, bundled services. And through that, we were able to develop a financial wellness position. So we have a coach that's grant-funded. What we found was this was a very successful way to provide these wraparound services for students that were at risk of falling through the cracks. We know that many of our students come to college without any awareness of how to manage money, how to manage credit, what kind of lifestyle they could imagine for themselves in a career, because most of them have been in subsistence living situations all of their life. And so it's that reframing, helping them understand that they can select a career and understand that there will be a living wage at the end of their educational path, and that they have tools and resources to manage their money while in college, and then to build equity and credit after college. We had great success with our students through a really amazing workforce education services program that we were able to identify students and connect them with these wraparound services that helped them select an appropriate career that would give them a living wage and a career pathway, and help them through college with financial wellness and actually starting from the very ground going up.
One of the things we realized through this grant that we received is that our objective was really to make sure our students were served in three pillars: work and income support, financial wellness, and education and career support. And what we found was that when we were able to bundle services together, the retention rate of our students was much higher. So with the grant that we received, we launched an emergency grant program, and that emergency grant program is really designed to make sure that our students have the measures in place to help ensure that they stay in school. And so if a student was in need of funding, we would have them complete a very quick application process. We would review that application and really kind of determine what that student's need was based on the application that they completed. And then if the student was approved for the emergency grant program, then we immediately connected that student to the financial wellness coach. So that was just another opportunity for us to bundle services together to make sure that we are providing optimal service to our students. All right, and so we talked quite a bit about the Workforce Education Services Program. And so the students that are a part of this program would be one of the main sources to refer students to the financial wellness coach. So in the Workforce Education Services Program, we primarily serve students that are receiving food benefits, cash assistance, they're displaced homemakers, they may have a justice involved background, and they may be receiving unemployment benefits. And so one of the things that we really work hard to do is to make sure that we are serving our students in a trauma-informed, with a trauma-informed framework, and ensuring that we are really utilizing those skills to make sure that we are supporting our students in a way that's strength-based. So when we do our intake with our students, we really want to build a relationship with them. So we're determining what their short-term goals are, their long-term goals are. We're also making sure that the student has a solidified plan for what they want to do when they pursue their educational goals. Because what we know is that when a student is unsure about what they want to pursue, the likelihood of them not completing is much greater.
We're at time, so we have to go to questions now.
Is there any truth to kind of the rumors, I guess, that are floating around that people that have a college degree now can't necessarily go out and get a good enough paying job that they can survive on? Is there truth to that? And if there is, how are you guys seeing that?
Sure. We're actually seeing such an uptick in the economy that is less and less true.
Good.
5 years ago, I would have said absolutely.
Okay.
We have folks that are in minimum wage jobs that are holding bachelor's and master's degrees. Not so much anymore. The economy has taken a real turn. Of course, that's not good for the college because that's our income, right? And so yet another reason we're so dependent on grants for that. Now, you know, what's important is to remember who our students are, that they don't come in with the mindset of a career and money as a value in that decision-making process, right? And so we have to sort of start from the beginning and train them up into that, and to recognize that they're going to get a job at the end, but they're going to get a career if they manage their life and their money properly. So that is, you know, we teach them about a career pathways, right? It's not just your first job. Now now you're embarking on something new and different. Maybe no one in your family has ever really done. So, yeah.
So you mentioned that through the program that you serve 55% of people at 150% below the federal poverty level. These funds, is where that most of the funds are available are for serving those that are up to 125% of the federal poverty level. How will you ensure that you're only serving those that are in that?
Sure. Yeah, we have an amazing planning and effectiveness department, and they are able to pull that data, and we can identify the students that we need to do outreach for that are exactly at or below the 125%. That's a great question.
Yes. In addition to that, we know that many of our students are Pell eligible. So when they complete the FAFSA, we will identify who those students are, and then, like Edie said, work very closely with our planning and effectiveness department.
So the grant that the emergency grant fund, that's used for things that come up beyond what the
absolutely. So we know that many of the reasons that our students don't complete is financial. It's not due to any academic issues. And so we also know that many of our students are just a flat tire away from dropping out. And so if we're able to help close the gap for them, that will definitely increase their persistence and retention. So students who were recent recipients of the emergency grant fund, their retention was 85% in them completing quarter to quarter, which is much higher than students who did not receive an emergency.
I just want to add that the work that our financial wellness coach does with these students and the work that the coaches in the Workforce Education Services provide, they are really starting from ground zero, right? And they are helping students identify for themselves what barriers there might be, what will their needs be as they get through college, what's their plan for paying for college afterwards, and then building assets. That's what we all go to college for, is to create a better life, right? Upward mobility. And so these are the conversations. What are your barriers now? What does your credit look like? How do you save money? We have a Share IBA account that we encourage students to use. This has been transformative for the students at Clark College.
And you know, when our students receive the emergency grant funds, if we don't want to put a band-aid on a problem, right? But what we want to do is help to educate them. And so those students who do receive this funding source, like we mentioned, we make sure they're connected with the financial wellness coach so that they can learn the skills and strategies they need to help ensure that they won't run into a similar problem in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next presenter is from Lighthouse Financial Resource Center. My name is Charlene Dolan. I'm the executive director with what used to be the Community Housing Resource Center, but is now, if this works right, the Lighthouse Resource Center. We changed our name, we changed our location, but we haven't changed the services that we've been providing and bringing to our community for many, many years. In fact, the Community Housing Resource Center has been around for nearly 25 years. But in its present state, and today, we are serving a very different population than we served many years ago. We are working with people coming to us that have credit needs, they're buried in debt, they're getting phone calls from creditors, they don't know how to handle it, they don't know what to do next, and many of them are homeless. And so what we're doing is we're helping to remove those barriers to housing, and other situations where they can maintain their housing by working with them addressing those issues. The flyer that I passed around more or less identifies on the right column what it is we're doing when somebody pays a visit to us. Before I get too far into this, I would like to introduce one of our board members, Steve Bernhoft, and Steve came in to kind of listen and support as well.
But we have a new board of directors that I'm very excited about also, as they look at what we're doing and want to continue with this work, but also to move the type of education we offer forward in our community. So we are helping our community build financial stability through the education and counseling we provide. What does this do? It opens up more housing options. It lowers rates on insurance when we have a better credit score. It lowers interest rates on the purchase of a car when many of them and many of the clients with whom we work are coming into us and saying, I'm paying an exorbitant price on my car, 28%, 30% on the loan. Well, when we can improve their credit score, that goes down, that can drop, but it also can mean more income coming in for the family. There's more employment opportunities. Do you know that although it's illegal for many employers to look at your credit report, they will, and they'll make a determination based on that. Lower credit card rates and the future of home ownership. Who needs our services? Our community does. But where do they come from? A lot of times they come from SHARE. We heard from Diane this morning, Council for the Homeless. Lots of referrals from them. Vancouver Housing Authority, the YWCA, Salvation Army. We have received many from Clark College, students that are looking to get their loans in deferment. And in general, our community. We see our seniors coming to us struggling, not being able to make that payment on their apartment because of the rising rents that are going on. So if we can help them and look at different ways to use their income, as limited as it may be, it's helping them to stabilize. The same with a young family that's struggling. And they come together with the same thing, issues that are addressed, they're addressing with too much credit or too much debt and not enough ability to be able to address it. We've also found through our research that, what is it, 6 out of every 10 families does not have a savings account adequate enough to meet an emergency. That's pretty staggering when you think about it. Wouldn't have $500 in a savings account for $1,000. So what we're working on when somebody comes to us is step by step the very basics. Starting with the credit score and the credit report, moving them forward with preparing an assessment as to what they need to do. And then from that, we'll look at different ways that we can help to settle some issues that are out there, resolve some debts, actually pick up the phone and call the creditors on their behalf and get them through that so that they can understand what it is and how they can move forward in order to make and preserve what life they have. Stabilize those things, get into housing, if we can remove those barriers, and move on. A fellow came to us not too long ago and in January referred to us from Council for the Homeless. He needed our help. Buried in debt once again, living in his car, 3 kids. He had a voucher, but he couldn't rent because the landlord was saying, hey, I can't rent to you. I see my time is up.
Well,
last year we had 300 families. So. And in order to continue the work we do need your support. Very quick closing. Through the work that we did, he was able to get housing and use his voucher. And he's now has a home for him and his family. Thank you. Questions?
You mentioned here the high certified housing financial counseling program.
Uh-huh.
Is that the way you work one-on-one or is it a group?
We are a high certified housing counseling agency, and they do require a protocol that we adhere to. Any other questions?
What was the reason for the change?
For the change from
to Lighthouse.
Oh, I think it was simply because we were able to now work with two other agencies, the Food Bank and the Lighthouse Community Credit Union, which is a CDFI, LMI credit union, and it just made for a natural affiliation. grateful to everyone. Thank you for the decision you have to make, and we appreciate this.
Thank you.
5 minutes is very fast. It does. All right. Well, we're focusing back on track. Our next presentation is from Consumer License Reform.
Hi, Brad. This is Melanie. We're with CVAP, and we have proposed a project we're calling Forward Momentum. Forward Momentum is addressing a need, and the need that we want to address is that there are a lot of people who do not have benefits of any type, that have no income of any type. So going through that process can be difficult, and it take a long time for people to obtain those benefits. A very frustrating process for many people. Also, a lot of those individuals in this community don't have anybody that can really support them. If you're not directly in a service someplace, which some aren't because they don't even have insurance yet, but some are, there is very few resources for them. We're one of the few agencies that provides resources to anybody that walks through our doors. You don't have to be engaged in any of our other services. Also, once they get it on benefits, then the myths begin. The myth is you can't get a job, because if you get a job, you lose your benefits. And we know that's not true. People with who are on benefits go to work all the time. They just need to know what the choices are they need to make about income, how to work their benefits, those types of things. Also, we know that benefits planning is extremely difficult. It varies from individual to individual to individual to individual. You can't blanket anything with this process. So you have to spend a lot of time with individuals. Finally, people need the support to do this, to really figure out how are my benefits impacted, but they don't have the access in this community that they really need. So what we're proposing is Forward Momentum, to help people take that step forward in life, to support people in obtaining those benefits and then maintaining those benefits in the way that's best for them, especially the SSI, SSDI that we're talking here. The project will hire one FTE. This FTE will be trained in benefits planning and SOAR. We'll talk a little bit more about those in a moment. Benefits planning, their job is to oversee that, to work with individuals one-on-one, and to really support the rest of the agency. We have seven programs here in Clark County, so their job will be to support the staff and those in other community agencies. They'll support them in applying for those benefits, and maintaining, learning the facts about those benefits, and developing a plan on how to maintain those benefits. They will receive referrals from community resources. People come to us all the time and say, so-and-so referred me, this agency referred me, that agency referred me. They come to through our doors and we engage at that point. Also, we will provide services in two of our local centers, the REACH Center, which is at the Center for Community Health, and the Val Ogden Center, which is our employment center, up on 4th Plain across town in Orchards. So, what will we be providing? SOAR. SOAR is SSI, SSDI, Outreach, Access, and Recovery. And this is for people who have no benefits, who have a mental health issue, who have substance use issue, who have a medical issue, and are having difficulty in life. They're either homeless or at risk of losing their housing. And so this is a rapid response, a rapid application process to get people on those benefits as soon as possible. So they have the medical benefits and other benefits that come along with those programs to benefit them. So they'll support them in doing that. Our target population is the 125 level or below. A lot of our folks, if you've ever been to our programs, you realize that's our wheelhouse. That's who we are. So, and then we figure that we can, it takes about 10 hours to support a person in those application process. So as we support them, we're looking at least the first year about 10 people. The second year, 20, and again, this is just for the one person who's doing this. They will also be supporting a number of other people in doing the same things. And then finally, we will use the WHO, the World Health Organization's Quality of Life Survey. So at the beginning, and as they move down the road through the benefit process, to see how their life improves. The other part that we will be providing is the benefits planning. This is for people who are already on Social Security, SSDI, SSI. This target population is a little bit higher, but the beauty is in our platform, we have other people trained in some of these areas. so that they will be meeting initially with people to get them on benefits, work with them as they're looking for employment and those types of things. But once they're employed, we have other people that we can pass them off to within our organization, or not pass them off to, but support them in connecting with, kind of a warm handoff within the org. And then, again, this takes about 40 hours of staff time per person. And we think that that's an average. You could take a whole lot more depending on the complications of the individual and what's going on in their lives. We think 15 people a year, and we think that WHO, again, will be applied to this population group. As far as our organization, we share hope, power renewal. We are a value-driven, front-time informed, peer-run organization. We have over 40 people working for us that are peers, living with these very traditions. So time is up. I talked fast. I tried to agree.
We have about 5 minutes for questions, though.
Yeah.
Is this open to anybody in the population who access the CDAP services? Or?
It's open to anybody in the population.
But
they'll have to come to CDOT, or
we will meet the income.
Yeah, meet the income criteria. And we'll go to where they are, too. Sometimes we go to where people are because they're uncomfortable leaving their homes or their environments, whatever the case may be.
And we're already getting requests. Actually, even agencies that have benefits planners have come to us and said, can you work with people? And that both SOAR and benefits planning take a lot of training to become certified in those things. So we have really limited access. We have one part-time staff that does SOAR that tries to work with as many people as she can. But there's a huge need in the community.
I'm one of two trained benefit planners at the moment. We have another one going through training next month. It's a very extensive training. And then you have to work with the Social Security Administration, which in itself takes extensive training.
I have a question. So someone finally gets SSI or SSDI benefits, right? And then they get that huge lump sum of the last, 24 months or 36 months or whatever it's been, right? And so then they'll get a check for 12 grand, 20 grand, whatever that is. Do you guys help them at that point and with advice, or are there, or do you get even more involved on how to help them successfully spend that money as opposed to?
We would prefer to send them. Our job is to empower people. That's one of the whole reasons we exist.
Yeah.
Let's help connect them to somebody who could really give them the expertise in that area. That's not our area of expertise. Who would you recommend off the top?
Well, I mean, if they've got credit and debt issues, then I would look at sending them to Lighthouse and see how they can best use that money for those things. Or if they need, repairs on their home, or really would depend on the person's situation, and then helping them access whatever resources. For people doing SOAR, there's the difference. There's people just doing it on their own, which I think nationally the acceptance rate is like 26%. But I know the SOAR acceptance rate in Clark County is above 80%. And so, Community Services Northwest, who's now CMAR, has Suzanne, who's the SOAR coordinator for Clark County. And so she does the collaboration system level stuff and kind of built that partnership up and has limited spaces to help people with applications. But we want to be the place people can come if they aren't hooked up with another agency that's already doing it. But Suzanne's done awesome work in Clark County to improve those rates.
And the national target is about 65% approval rate. So we think that we can meet or beat that. And we're supporting people now through the agency doing this. We want to expand the service. We have, at the moment, one person that provides SOAR to individuals. And we have to limit that time based on, when that person's available and other issues. Would be a full-time person dedicated to this purpose.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Have control.
Thank you.
All.
Our
thank
next
you.
Presentation is from Share for the IDA program.
Okay.
rate are met, the IDA program was able to provide matched funds. For homeownership, business, and secondary education, the match rate is 4-to-1, which means people save $1,000 and we match $4,000 for a total of $5,000 towards their asset. For Clark College, we have the highest match rate that's allowed through our original grant FP, which is an 8-to-1 match, so people save $500 and receive $4,000 towards their education that's split up over 4 quarters, so it gets them through an entire year at Clark College. So unlike many programs, the requirements for the IDA program are minimal, and therefore it's more accessible to members of the community. To qualify, people need to be under 200% of the federal poverty level based on their size, be a resident of Clark County, and also have current earned income, and be under the asset limit, which is fairly high at $10,000. So through my experience working through this program over the last couple of years, the earned income requirement has actually motivated certain individuals to seek employment so that they could try to qualify for the program. I've seen that multiple times. While the funds that are provided for people to accomplish their goals through the IDA program is an obvious step up, this program does not just hand out money and send people on their way. There is a financial education as well as budgeting component and that people participate in prior to being able to access the funds. And we use progressive engagement. People come in with a variety of different skills and knowledge based around budgeting and financial education. So for those going to school, so they're asset specific for whatever asset that people choose. For those going to school, they're going to meet with an academic advisor, put together an education plan. For people starting a business, we refer out to our community partners, so the Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber, the Chamber of Commerce, also SCORE, to meet with a business professional to develop a solid business plan before we'll do approval for the funding. And then for people buying a home, we generally refer to the White House Resource Center for first-time homebuyers classes, and also if people need any more in-depth debt management than our program offers. So to date, 74 people in our community have purchased homes through the IDA program. It's huge. And so oftentimes in partnership with Evergreen Habitat for Humanity, we work with them a lot. 74 people have started a small business. 32 Clark College students have finished out an entire year of study through the IDA program. And 26 have received funding for other accredited universities. There are currently 63 participants on the program. In conclusion, I'll leave you with words from some of our graduates who were asked in an online survey what they found useful about the IDA program. I'm very thankful and grateful that I was able to share IDA. Jennifer was very friendly and kind, and she helped me with the whole process. I was able to buy all the machines I wanted to provide better quality work for my startup business. Thank you so much. I was able to fund studies I would have had to go into debt for, and the staff was always helpful and available. I also like the budgeting and the learning components. The fact that there is a program that helped to support my education as I become more self-sufficient as a single mom, it's unlike any other program, extremely helpful for people trying to get a leg up. Happy I was able to receive the services and help I received. Thank you. The concept is brilliant and actually helpful, not a lot of red tape, easy to implement. It got me thinking about the future and helped me when I needed it in more ways than just the extra money. The assistance really helped me when I thought there was no way I could do it. And lastly, hope. The hope key tag is still on my key ring, and I'm daily reminded of where I was and where I am going to not give up.
Any questions?
What is the match rate now?
It's 4-to-1 for business, education, and home, and then Clark is 8-to-1.
Did I read in the application that the federal funding is coming to the close?
Yes.
Yeah. So how is that impacting the program, the length of the contract, and how much federal and how much match you have, and what happens to people who come in now?
It's greatly impacting. So, the federal, there were two separate grants. We're in the last year of the last federal grant, which was the majority of our funds. So, but it was a federal grant, and any other grants that we have, they do half and half. So, AFI, Assets for Financial Independence, is a federal, they match $2,000, and then if it's Clark student, Clark Foundation. funds, and they would match half our business. We've had county funding, you know, and some private as well. So without, a larger amount of funding as, you know, we had through the federal, then it's not realistic that this program can continue.
So as far as the application,
providing additional funding as far as the contract goes to change the parameters of the savings amount, time, and all of that. Because we have a restriction, people have to save for at least 6 months. That wouldn't necessarily have to be an open mandate, say 3 months, if you know that was written into any contract.
What's the minimum amount that someone can save? Is it $25 a month?
some point had later time frames. And so I think that's why Pick said, oh, we're not on for another 10 minutes or
something. So,
not a big deal. I just think that's why.
But our main thing is
So we have a
for the low-income residents nominated to support by the entity that serves predominantly low-income or has people in yourself and then it is, and it's a federal income. It's not even a federal one. And so I think you could get into either one of those community rep or low-income.
Would it make the most sense?
No, we only have to take them once we have them. But if we put you on our schedule, so we have them, and then I also have an independent. And whenever we open the show, I always come back to the cabinet with our next department split. And I also look for three people who apply if they are already in that program. I make sure I reach out to them. So we really want to do that. I don't think Rich is leaving any time soon, and that's not true.
I'll wait until you look away and I'll be like,
Seven. Yeah. I take a little nap. Oh. Yeah.
relief. We have seen nearly double between 2017 and 2018 on a number of bankruptcies, Chapter 7 bankruptcies we've assisted in. And 2019 is the one at the bottom, that is near to date. So just in the first quarter, we've already seen the same amount of debt and debt spikes that we saw in total last year. Domestic violence, that's family law that we do with the YWCA. Similarly, upward trajectory, 2019 is on track to be even more. Family law, same thing. Each year, we're just sort of doubling our services the past couple years. And housing justice, which is in general our eviction defense and also other landlord-tenant issues. Once again, the last point is year to date. And so we anticipate that to be way more than 2018 was. Elder law was a program we started last year, specifically in wills and estates, but also other elder abuse issues. In total, we saw 23 clients in 2018. Planning year to date, we've already seen half that amount. Same for our lay guardianship program, we're at half what we saw in total for the previous year of our program. Latinx is our collaborative event with Latino community partners, providing access to legal aid for folks in the Latino community, specifically those with who are undocumented and need estate-based access services. And so, our newest program that we're working on is Fresh Start. This is sort of the term we use to tie in three big areas that we think are going to help folks build assets, reduce debt, and ultimately move out of poverty and obtain housing and employment. So we address legal fines. Debt defense, as we talked about, is a big deal. Preventing bankruptcy or helping them file bankruptcy if that's necessary. And then finally, criminal records, whether they're eligible for faking, expunging, or stealing. I think we can help with. We do that on a walk-in basis at certain programs, and then by appointment if necessary. So, in all these things, we've noticed that we actually have a little push that we need to do to back up a little bit and support our clients even better. And so Ashley's going to play the role and not be giving you legal advice, but hypothetically, if you are a client and meeting with her, she's going to give you some specific instructions.
All right. You're a single mom, one minor child, your husband's abusive, and you want a divorce. You need to file a petition and necessary forms to get a protection order. You need to make the necessary copies. You need to go to ex parte. By doing that, you need to give your forms to the court before 11 a.m. any given day of the week. Return to court at 1, find out who that judge is, and go to that courtroom. If the judge grants your order, you have to serve all the parties of the case, which varies if Tannis is involved. So if you're denied the order, go speak with another lawyer. So you need to file a divorce. Fill out all necessary forms, which include a petition, a summons, a financial declaration, a sealed record sheet, a fee waiver, a citation, vital statistic form, case cover sheet, proof of service, and a parenting plan. If you cannot pay the $336 filing fee, you can get a waiver if you qualify. So you need to do that also by ex parte, and you need to serve the clerk all of those forms all together. So the same process, go to court before 11, return at 1 p.m. If the judge grants your order, serve all the parties.
So, can someone tell me what you're supposed to go do now?
That sounds like so much fun.
On top of that, you realize that your parenting plan that you turned in is not a valid parenting plan for 60 days to 1 year.
Yeah. So, what we've decided we need to do is help clients navigate these cases.
Yeah.
So, from the front end, I realize my time's up, but you can get what we're going to try to do. Using non-attorneys before they see the attorney, during the time that they're receiving services, checking them in, and then on the back end, making sure that they actually successfully filed. So thank you.
Thank you.
Just leave it on screen.
So I
have you have 5 minutes.
So where do you get your referrals from?
Yep, we receive our referrals for a combination of the CLEAR hotline, which is a statewide hotline that refers throughout the state. About 25% of our referrals come through there. People can walk into our office, call us, message us on Facebook, email us, get referred from another community partner.
So my
clear and that it can take days to try to get through, and then you still have eligibility, you know, criteria which you'll accept or reject. Has that percentage pool, you know, increased, decreased? Is it a problem still?
Can you talk about that? So we did realize that clear was kind of creating a barrier for a lot of our clients, so that's when we decided to just take more walk-in clients, more calls by phone.
And we will also coach clients on how to call clear and get through. We have very specific ways. You have to act like you're winning something off the radio.
Two other quick questions. Yep. The Northwest Justice Project, mm-hmm. and the connection with that, and the other one is you used to do workshops for to help people complete the paperwork. Is that still valid?
Yep, I'll take the first one and you can take the second one. So Northwest Justice Project is a law office that has 17 offices throughout the state of Washington. So all their attorneys are paid and work for them, but they take cases pro bono fully. They operate the CLEAR hotline. So we are not related to them, but we work in tandem with them to fill the gaps they can't get.
Okay. So your second question, that was, to my recollection, back in 2006 to 2008, if I'm right, our director was holding sessions for certain clients that needed the forms in a group setting. What ended up coming to the light was, it was kind of sketchy, it was a gray line legal advice that an attorney needs to guide that conversation to say what forms in the process.
Is there an income requirement for the newest program, the one where you're looking at waiving and vacating fees and stuff?
Yeah, it's 200% federal poverty. But we do, we look at liquid assets. So if somebody, you know, owns a vehicle or even a house, we're not counting that against them. We collect that information. We don't expect them to liquidate their house to pay for an attorney.
What is the lay guardianship program?
So that is where if you want to be a guardian of somebody else, an adult who's incapacitated for whatever reason, maybe it's a developmentally delayed child who becomes 18, or it's a partner and you're older, you can get the court's permission to serve as their guardian so they can gain a lot of input. But it's very complicated and you can't do it without an attorney, so we help.
Do you know what my account for the increase in services is? Is it a need? Or is it your availability? Or I mean,
yeah. What do you think?
You've been here for like 10 years, so you know.
It's the need of the community and of realizing that the problems that they may not have realized were legal issues. It's more around found that they are legal issues and we can help. Yeah. So I'd say it's both.
Doing a lot of education and outreach. I think contributes to that. And not insisting that all our referrals come through CLEAR.
So does the Housing Solutions Center refer clients to you?
Yes. I mean, not formally as they would through other things, but we hear referrals from them all the time. And then we also are part of the consortium through the City of Vancouver, so we get referrals from all those partners.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that concludes all of the presentations. We made it through two meetings. Congratulations. A lot of time we'll be sitting here listening to the different programs. The next step is going to be for you guys, if you have not yet started reading the applications, make sure you do start reading the applications because they usually take time, and then scoring those applications. The scores are due by May 1st. It gives me only a couple of days to actually put your scores all together and get them in the right ranking order so that when we meet in May, we have that information available for you to start talking about the discussions of funding and what that's going to look like in each of the categories for the Homeless Crisis Response System and then also for the Community Action Programs. So the May meeting is a really fun, big deal. We will invite all of the applicants to be at that meeting, so if they're available, they can be there, and you can ask them questions regarding partial funding if those types of questions come up, depending on how much funding is available in each of the categories.
That's
May 7th, the first Tuesday, so it'll be our first Tuesday meeting, and it will be back I was able to work with public health and ask them to switch rooms with us, so we will still be in that first conference room that we've traditionally been in. Any questions about the application process or scoring or any of that type of thing? So if you have any questions or if you need anything about getting into Zoom grants or any of those types of things, make sure you reach out to me as soon as possible so I can make sure that you guys have access and are getting into the applications to be able to get the score and make sense. Adam, did you have a different question?
Yeah, I need help. Everything was like such a blur like a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, and as we get to this point now, I just want to be reintroduced to whatever I need to get into.
Yeah, so I'm going to help Doug right after this meeting and just show him how to log in to get into the state. So if you have a chance to stay after, then that's fine, or we can schedule another time that we can get together. So one of the requests that we had at the January meeting was to have a conversation with Kate regarding the Homeless Action Plan. And so we did have some questions sent in to us ahead of time, so I went ahead and sent those over to Kate. She'd be prepared. She has just a presentation just to give some of that information and to help, you know, visualize some of the information that she's going to be providing. So I'm going to switch it over to Kate. And then any questions that you might have about the Homeless Action Plan. I also brought a couple of extra copies. It does not want to let go of the long period. I love it. There we go.
She did that.
Now.
No, we'll wait. Thanks. Okay. Well, good morning. Rebecca had let me know that the board had questions regarding the Homeless Action Plan, and we're certainly glad to answer them. I had gotten a swath of questions prior to this meeting, and I'm glad to address those. I will just kind of give you a preface that the questions didn't necessarily interface with the Homeless Action Plan, and so if it seems like we're going too far down a road and this wasn't the purpose of myself being here, just let me know and we can go down a different road.
And if there were any questions that were very data specific, we're going to have Dale at the May meeting, and so he can kind of help where Kate might not be able to answer some of the questions that Kate knows everything that's going on in her agency, so I'm
everything.
Yes.
So what I thought I would start with is there were some questions that indicated to me that there's additional opportunities to learn more about the Housing Solutions Center. And before I show you a few of the graphics that I included, I want to just let you know that the purpose of the Housing Solutions Center is to help guide clients through what programming they might be eligible for and to not put the onus on clients to guide themselves or to have to navigate by knowing what programs are available or understanding kind of, you know, what programs they need to ask for. Because the reality is there's so many programs. We provide referrals to over 40 different housing programs, as well as last year, for example, served over 200 people through four different diversion funding sources, and made hundreds of referrals to different entities such as the YWCA, WorkSource, the Managed Care Organizations, and other agencies each year. And so there's a lot going on there. And we never expect people to be able to come to us and say exactly what they need. We, every step of the process, we have triaging questions that help us understand what's going on in the individual's lives so we can provide them with resources that they might be eligible for. The other thing that I like to share is that the amount of resources, particularly longer-term housing programs in this community, in 2018 met 10% of the overall need. 10%. And so what that says to me is that we have an enormous gap between those who are seeking longer-term housing programs and those who are actually getting into longer-term housing programs. And we know that the only way that we can end homelessness for someone is we have to get them into stable housing. If we are talking about reducing the effects of homelessness on someone, shelter, transitional housing certainly does that. But it doesn't end homelessness if we place someone in a shelter, no matter how long that shelter may be available to them or in transitional housing. Why? Because we know that their stay is going to end in those two types of facilities or programs.
Hey, Kate, can I add something to that?
Sure.
So 10% of the need for housing was met last year. 40% of people seeking shelter got into shelter. And so we had a gap there too. You know, we do need more shelter. Understand that the pool of money is the same for both permanent housing and for shelter. So I cannot, or we as a community cannot increase shelter without reducing the funding available for permanent housing, which would take down even more the availability of that. And likewise, we cannot increase the availability of permanent housing without limiting the amount of funding available for shelter. So, I mean, that's just the reality of why we deal with balances between we're putting this much funding for housing, we're putting this much funding for shelter, we're putting this much funding for transitional housing, things like that. Sorry.
That's right. So, looking at the Housing Solutions Center, we invite anyone to give us a call. When they call, we start with that triage of questions. The first thing we're trying to find out is where did the individual spend the night last night? We want to see that that was in Clark County. And it's not that we're looking beyond last night, but that's the indicative question that we're looking to have an answer to. The next thing is we want to find out what their living situation is. Are they experiencing homelessness? Are they escaping domestic violence? That qualifies as someone experiencing homelessness. Did they spend the night on the street? Did they spend the night in a shelter? If they spend the night in a motel, who paid for it? That also helps us understand whether the individual qualifies for homelessness programs as well as programs that serve people who are at risk. If someone is in their own unit but they're having a hard time paying rent, or they're doubled up or couch surfing, staying with family or friends, you know, on the couch or in a spare bedroom, then we refer to those folks as at risk of homelessness. And we do have programs, particularly within right now the city of Vancouver, that can help people either remain housed by assisting them with rent or rent arrears, or helping someone who is in an unstable housing situation move into a more stable housing situation. The county also has prevention funds. Right now, they're completely out, but I'm sure in July there will be more to be able to offer to folks here in Clark County. So folks call, and we triage and find out what's going on. If someone after triage is indicating that they're experiencing homelessness, then we put their phone call in the HMIS system. And so we do track every single phone call of someone who calls who's experiencing homelessness. If someone is just at risk of homelessness, we don't track all those calls, and the reason is just because of the sheer number. We're talking thousands of calls of people who are at risk of homelessness, and we just don't have the capacity. If we serve them or even begin to assess if someone might be eligible for a prevention program, then we do put that in HMIS, and so we track the need overall of those who are experiencing homelessness, but not everyone who's experiencing an unstable situation. So when we're talking to someone at the housing hotline, we invite them to come in either to the Housing Solutions Center to meet with a staff member, or we talk to them about what may work for them. We are able to do housing assessments up at the North County Food Bank, We're there once a week. We're also at St. Anne's in Washougal once a week. We're at the Navigation Center once, sometimes twice a week. We also go to Share House when there's a need there. And then I also have staff that accompany our outreach teams that will literally go out and even do housing assessments right there in the woods if someone's camping. We are always dealing with capacity challenges, and so it might take a little longer to be able to do an assessment with someone by one of my staff. But for that reason, we've also trained a number of professional staff throughout the community to do housing assessments. So for example, there's a staff member at the Lifeline Sobering Center who can do housing assessments. There's a staff member at the Perch, the Youth Day Center, who can also do housing assessments. Outreach staff can do housing assessments. And we continue to grow those that have those skills, as well as share shelter staff. And what's very important to us is that anyone who's doing a housing assessment, that they be incredibly well-trained and follow the ethics of being a housing assessor. Part of those ethics is making sure that you're not translating your own biases into the assessment. Because the fact is that we all are amazing advocates, and the reality is that an assessment exists so that we can provide more objective assessment of what's going on in someone's life. Why? Because we don't nearly have enough resources to be able to serve everyone. And so the assessments help us understand what are the vulnerabilities that someone's dealing with. And all the programs, from permanent supported housing down to refugee housing, focus on those that have the highest needs in the community. And so what that means is folks who are able to advocate well for themselves, folks who have income, folks who don't have high needs, they rarely get served through a housing program in this community. Why? Because they're most likely to resolve their homelessness due to their own resiliency. We do have diversion assistance through the Housing Solutions Center, and the majority of those dollars are actually through private fundraising that the Council for the Homeless does. We also receive a small amount of dollars through the county, as well as dollars from different private funding groups. The idea with diversion is that if we can keep someone out of the system, then we want to. We have a lot of folks who drive up to the Housing Solutions Center who just became homeless a few days ago because they weren't able to sustain their rent increases. You know, we have folks rent increase $300, $500, etc. And then ask, why weren't you able to just transition to a new home? A lot of folks just don't have the money saved to move into a new home. Others may be dealing with barriers that just don't make it easy for people to find a new home. And so we then offer diversion assistance to folks instead of an assessment, and folks can choose. If they want an assessment, they absolutely can have one. But if diversion sounds like something that better fits their needs, which often means they can receive assistance much more quickly, that we are really working with them to empower them to break down their own barriers and helping to connect them with landlords who might be willing to flex their screening criteria and resources that might help them break down their barriers to housing. The Volunteer Lawyers Program is a great example of a partner that we work with, as well as the Lighthouse Community Resource Center, because they're able to break down criminal background barriers. They're able to break down arrears that folks have that are stopping them from getting into apartments. What's amazing, we just had one client. We paid $1,200 in arrears that were owed to a landlord from 2014. That $1,200 was stopping them from being able to get into any apartment in the community. The household was making $40,000 a year. They had the money. They could sustain it, but they had an enormous barrier. And so we paid that $1,200, and that household was able to move into that apartment next day. So that makes a huge difference. So, folks, call the Housing Hotline. They're welcome to come in for an assessment or connect with another assessment entry point, and then they have the opportunity to choose whether they want to pursue diversion if they're among one of the populations that we serve. So that means families, veterans, seniors, LGBTQ-identified families, as well as those who identify as having an adult who's a person of color. Those last two populations, we received a very specific grant to provide diversion to those households. We're continuing to work on providing diversion to more households. We're focused on people with disabilities, but again, you know, it just costs dollars to be able to increase that capacity. If someone has an assessment and they don't score high enough on the assessment to qualify for a housing program, then we have them talk to one of our staff through a diversion coaching session, and that can be for anyone, but it's really about like what resources have you looked into, you know, can we connect you to other resources, and you know, what's your plan next, and helping them kind of walk through it. If someone does diversion, and within the 2 month period that diversion serves households, they're not able to stabilize in housing, then we'll offer a housing assessment to them to see if they might qualify for a longer term program. If someone has a housing assessment and their score qualifies for a housing program, then what we do is we put them on what we call priority pools. And the priority pool is referenced because people are prioritized based on their housing assessment score, as well as the length of time that they've been experiencing homelessness. And so, for example, when a housing program opens up a slot, Impact Request has a program opening in one of the Rapid Housing programs, then we go to the top of our Rapid Housing pool and refer whomever is on the top that might qualify for that program. And so what that means is there are some people who may be able to get into housing pretty quickly, and there's others who may be waiting a long time. And one of the ideas behind that is that the needs are higher for whomever got referred and lower for those folks who are waiting a longer period of time. So here's another picture. And I did this one because there are questions about the assessments. We actually use two different assessments. First one is called the VI SPDAT, and this is from an agency in Canada called Org Code. It's one that's used nationally through a number of continuum of cares, including in Portland. And this is for anyone that comes into the Housing Solutions Center that is not experiencing chronic homelessness. And so if someone has been homeless for over a year period and has a disability or has been experiencing homelessness for over 3 years with four different episodes, then they would qualify as chronically homeless. And so then we would provide a VAT assessment. And that VAT assessment is just an even more in-depth understanding of what's going on in a household's life. The VAT assessment allows us to bring in third-party feedback regarding individuals, because the fact is that these are the folks who are most symptomatic in their mental health and or their physical health. And so sometimes sitting down with someone and asking them questions is just completely ineffective because they're not in a place where they're able to answer questions. And so that means we can go to outreach staff who have worked with them for a long time because they've been living on our streets, or to behavioral health staff who may have engaged with them at various times, or even physical health staff who have served them in the ER. If they're willing to give a release, then we'll seek out additional information about them to better understand what their vulnerabilities are. If someone doesn't have an extremely high need, then it's the VI SPDAT that we provide. And we try to just look at objectively, you know, what's going on in this person's life to decide which assessment makes the most sense. If we're unsure, we'll usually do the VAT, because it just usually means that they have high needs. And so, again, this one I like because on the far right shows you all the different housing agencies that we provide referrals to. Veteran Affairs, so that's the VASH vouchers. Section 8 for veterans who have very high needs. As well as Lifeline Connections, who have newer tenant-based rental assistance programs, which looks very much like Rapid Housing, so we provide referrals to them. In 2018, we provided referrals of individuals to about it was 248 households. Yes, 248 households. And so that over doubled the number of referrals provided in 2017. And so while 10% of the need was met, that actually went up from 6% in 2017. So what that tells me is we are seeing more programs come online in the community. So a few of the questions. One, in the Homeless Action Plan, it says that there's about 2,400, and I underline individuals because it actually it's households, 24 households, including about 1,400 children, that experienced homelessness. And there's a number of ways to count the number of people or number of households that are experiencing homelessness in Clark County. Point in time count is one of them. And the number of people who engaged in any way with the Housing Solutions Center is another. We see engagement through our outreach team, so they focus on people who are literally living on the street. We see engagement through our emergency shelters, even our severe weather shelters. The majority of them enter data into HMIS, as well as our satellite assessment areas and those who are doing assessments on behalf of the Housing Solutions Center. And so if someone were to ask me, you know, is that every single person that's experiencing homelessness in the community? The reality is I have no idea. you know, I don't know for sure, but we definitely want to look at the best available data possible. And looking at those who engage with the Housing Solutions Center in any capacity is a good data set to look at. And we continue to do more so that we can make sure that we're engaging with folks who are outside or experiencing domestic violence. That's another challenging population where not everyone will connect with us, and we rely on the YWCA to help them connect with the Housing Solutions Center in whatever way that might look. We're very fortunate to have a YWCA staff member at the Housing Solutions Center, which makes a huge difference. So while we're not wholly implying that every single person experiencing homelessness, it is a good indicator of the total number, among other indicators. So the Housing Solutions Center, do we track what sort of help was requested? Our focus is on shelter and housing. And so if someone called us and asked, you know, I want to know how to get in touch with DSHS, we would just indicate that it was an information and referral call. And that we put in the system. We track specifically if someone was calling for emergency shelter or housing programs. The key is what was their initial call regarding. And yes?
No, I finished your sentence. I need to interrupt you.
That's right. And so we can track that number, and that's why we can share, you know, this is the percentage of people who are seeking emergency shelter versus this is the percentage of people who are seeking longer-term housing. And there's a large percentage of people that were looking for both, which is, of course, understandable.
So, Kate, my question was, that 2459 number, would that also include people who the outreach teams have contacted and they've entered that data in HMIS?
So it wouldn't. What that would do is that would look at anyone who the outreach team is engaged who is interested in emergency shelter or longer-term housing programs.
Thank you.
So regarding phone calls, we answer all phone calls of folks who are experiencing homelessness, not necessarily everyone who calls. So this was a question regarding the Housing Solutions Center quarterly report, and I know all of you, or you may not, you don't have the research. Okay, so we submit a quarterly report, and this data that was shared, this 2,113, was from our quarter three data, and our goal was 3,150 households. And what I think is most pertinent here is quarter four, which is the end of the year. And so out of the 2,400 households that we were going to assess for non-prevention, so basically the housing that's focused on people experiencing homelessness, we provided close 2,339 assessments. And then 750 assessed for prevention, again, close of 586. Many of these numbers are dependent on, A, the number of people that engage, and we're always working to engage more, but sometimes, you know, when it's a bright and sunny day and there hasn't been one since the fall, we'll see very few people, as well as we tend to see a lull in the summer with a huge rush coming back in September, and I know those of you who work with people experience homelessness, you probably see something similar. And so we're always working to achieve these goals, and with the prevention assessment, the fact is we don't do assessments unless there's prevention programs to place people in. And so had the city, for example, not invested in prevention assistance, this number would have been probably like 100, because there isn't a huge amount of prevention assistance through the county.
Mm-hmm. So I know typically we do an annual report, but with this last contract, we did 18 months for our programs. So do you think those numbers might actually, the goal might actually be an 18-month amount versus a 12-month?
I couldn't remember. And so if it is, we'll fly by those.
Yes, I think it is an 18.
Good.
You're very well.
We'll crush those goals. So great question regarding the connectivity between the Vancouver Housing Authority and HMIS. The fact is that the VHA system and the HMIS system do not talk to each other. The only VHA program that's entered into HMIS is the VASH vouchers. And the reason is because that's a requirement of the Veterans Affairs Office. Right now, there's an effort through Providence Corps, which is a Portland entity, to try to bring together a number of data systems, including the Housing Authority, Vancouver and Evergreen Schools, HMIS, and a few others. But the challenge is that the lawmakers around HMIS have taken incredible care to make sure that that is private information. And therefore, there are numerous challenges related to sharing information across data systems. And so we're still trying to work those out, and the fact is I don't know if we're gonna be able to share data or not, but we're still trying to work on it. The greatest sharing of data that does occur is at the state level, where DSHS is able to cross-reference statewide HMIS data with DSHS data.
And I, just to add emphasis to what you said and to make it really clear, the sharing of data is not a local choice. The sharing of data, our ability to share data between HMIS and anything else, is limited by legislation. State law and federal law, but really state law specifically. A difference between HIPAA and the HMIS protections, they both deal with confidentiality. HIPAA really focuses on protection of the data, the confidential data. HMIS has a slightly larger focus. They still care about confidentiality a lot, but they have a huge emphasis on consent of sharing of the information. You know, so for HMIS data to be shared with healthcare providers and stuff like that, we have to change all the consent forms, not just between the agencies that are entering data in HMIS, but down to the individuals that are giving their original consent to have the data entered regarding how that data is shared and used.
I know that's helped us a lot because we changed the release of the ROI with Council for the Homeless that allows our staff now to go and follow up with those other agencies. So if what we've done in the past is we refer people to Housing Solutions through the HSSP grants, and then we couldn't check in on whatever program they were referred to, so Salvation Army or Janus Youth or any of them. And now, because we changed that ROI, we can. And so I think if as a system, if we can do that more, I think it would allow us to really be able to follow up with those
Absolutely.
Situations.
But And what you're talking about, though, are changes within the same HMIS system.
Right.
And what we're talking about here in terms of sharing data with CORE is sharing between different systems,
right.
Like the homeless system and healthcare, behavioral health,
right.
Stuff like that, which is a slightly different ballgame. It's not just a simple changing of ROIs. My only reason to interrupt Kate in this and basically restate or emphasize what she's already stating is I really want you guys to understand it's not up to Council for the Homeless. You know, it's not up to the county. There is a willingness and a desire on all the parties involved to increase the sharing of information across the systems. What it's really going to require is some work with Department of Commerce, some work with DSHS, and some work with the healthcare providers in terms of HIPAA as well, but it's not just on HIPAA, to make sure that privacy and consent laws are complied with.
So the question around the DHA data and the HMIS was more, in my mind when I read it, was more to get system data, not individual person data, so that when you know, for instance, what DHA's wait list is for how many homeless, of course, we get an idea of unmet need. I mean,
yes.
Well, and the tough part too with the like the VHA waitlist, for example, is there's a lot of like cross clients,
mm-hmm.
and so if without being able to look at it on an individual basis, it would be difficult to be able to share like this is the need. However, you know, it would just be able to move like we have an enormous need to an even more enormous need, you know, in general. So the action plan, indeed, we have people who call the Housing Solutions Center. Who do not have any interest in emergency shelter and housing programs. And so it might be information or referral. It could be that people are just trying to find out things. We have a lot of parents or well-meaning community members or you know, faith leaders or partners who call to try to just like learn more information. And if they are able to give us enough where like they can share the name of the person and give us a release, then we'll put them in there and indicate that they're a part of the system. If we don't get a written release, then the records, they like just disappear in the system within 2 months. So that written release is really important, and that's why we want to engage with folks in person. Regarding knowing what programs exist, in fact, sometimes that makes it even more complicated because, like Share Aspire, for example, if you've been around this community for a long time, we get a lot of people who just call and like, you know, I want Share Aspire. And it's understandable because that was the only program 10 years ago and very much what people, you know, were seeking. And so now what we let folks know is, you know, we're going to ask you some questions and we'll let you know what programs you might be eligible for once we understand more about what's going on in your life. And the reality is if someone gets referred to a housing program, they have every right to turn it down, and then we'll just keep them on the priority pool, and the next one that they're eligible for comes up, we'll check in and see if they might be interested. We also do that with shared living. There are some shared living programs that we'll refer folks to, but there are some people that feel very strongly that shared living is not an option for them, and that's perfectly fine. We'll just put them back onto the list. We do let them know, though, that we don't know how much longer it might take to get them into a housing program. So regarding the full assessment, it's up to the individual. If they, A, you know, after they talk to someone at the housing hotline, if they want to come in for a housing assessment, if they want to engage with someone for a housing assessment. If they don't today and they decide in 2 weeks they want to, that's perfectly fine. If folks start an assessment and don't want to finish it, also fine. They can come back whenever they're ready. And then as far as choosing between assessment and diversion, if at any point someone's done with diversion, they want to do assessment, that's perfectly fine. So with the VAT assessment, so what I'd like to clarify is that the majority of folks get VIS-VAT assessments. Everyone who does either a VAT or a VIS-VAT assessment has had a very in-depth training. We also have agreement forms that folks sign around confidentiality and around not adding in their personal biases, as well as any assessment that is conducted, particularly the VATs that are more in-depth. Our HSC program director reviews it to make sure that across the norm of scores that the VAT has appropriate scores. What's really important with the VAT is that norming of scores so that someone who has the very highest need, like a level 5, that everyone else has a similar need at that level 5. So with the VAT, again, that's the highest level of assessment. The only programs that use the VAT are the permanent supported housing programs that serve people who are chronically homeless. And so the primary funding source of those is the continuum of care, which is through HUD. And so that's something that HUD requires. So if we don't do a VAT for all those requesting shelter, how do we access what other program will fit? And so the reality is that we want to try to meet people where they are, recognizing that if we have a shelter bed available tonight, we're not going to stop them from going into the shelter bed because they haven't done an assessment. And so we'll refer them, you know, and their family, for example, to Orchards Inn if there's a family shelter space available, and then say, hey, you know, give us a call back when you're ready to do assessment. The case managers at all the shelters know the need for an assessment, or what we often say, to get on the path of longer-term housing. And many of the staff at the shelters are actually trained to be able to do assessments themselves, trying to break down barriers for folks. So regarding eligibility for an assessment, it's simply that someone's experiencing homelessness, which could include living in a motel that's being paid for by a nonprofit or a governmental entity. It could also mean escaping domestic violence. And any of those folks could absolutely have an assessment. We definitely track those who are assessed, and basically anyone who's experiencing homelessness to understand the unmet need. I think we could probably all agree in this room that if we could give every single person, all 2,600 households, a Section 8 voucher, we probably would. And, you know, it's debatable. But that, I mean, I'd love to do that.
I would.
Yeah, because the odds are they would be stable in housing. The unfortunate thing is that we just don't have the resources to be able to do that, and so that's why we have to triage households and focus on those that have the highest needs, because they are the folks who are being served in the greatest way throughout our community.
And sorry about all my interruptions, but these are small snippets of time that we get to have these conversations. So another question I get often, or not so much a question, it's more of a comment or a complaint, is why don't we consider people who are couch surfing, people who are be able to sleep over with neighbors and friends, to be homeless? And why are we so restrictive and go with the HUD definition of homelessness? And it, you know, honestly, it's the same kind of answer as Kate just said about the Section 8 vouchers. It's because we have to triage due to limited resources, and because we focus on vulnerability. And the reality is that someone who is unsheltered, which is what, you know, the HUD definition of homeless is, or is escaping domestic violence, is more vulnerable than someone who is couch surfing. And that's why we have to prioritize them for an assessment. I think as a community, we would be a lot more open to increasing the definition criteria if there were capacity to serve people if we changed the definition criteria. But the limiting factor of who is getting served is not the definition of homelessness. It's the resources that are available. And the definitions we are using, which are appropriate definitions, are really a mechanism of triage to prioritize the most vulnerable. And would you add anything to that, or?
No.
Did you have a question? I'd like to follow up with it. I'm a new board member, so my questions will probably reflect that from time to time because, excuse me, I'm coming up to speed. Part of the homeless population that we have in our community, and every community, is a transient population, as opposed to families here in the county that have found themselves out of a home for whatever reason. Do transient homeless people receive the same level of consideration as those who have been living in Clark County for some period of time?
So I'll share. We actually collect information about someone's past zip code where they lived in stable housing. And we do that every time someone calls the homeless management information system when they call the hotline. And interestingly, over 80% of folks indicate a Clark County zip code that was their previous stable living situation.
80%.
And I share that because I think there's a big stigma in the community that most people who are experiencing homelessness are not from this community. And in fact, 80% very much are. Only 5% indicate a zip code from the Portland area, and then only 10% indicate a zip code from the Portland metro area, which is really very low. So regarding people who are transient, the fact is they're moving from place to place. And so if they decide that Clark County is the place that they want to stay, and they spend the night in Clark County for one night, then yes, we're glad to serve them in any way that we can. The difficulty is that beyond winter sheltering, it's very rare that we can serve an individual, a couple, a household, that particular day or night that they're looking for help. And so in order for someone who might be new to the community to receive help, they have to stick around for a while. And so I think that we really do serve few people that don't tend to stay in the community. And if someone decides to stay in the community, it's likely because they found some folks who they trust, which is a good thing. And so that may also help them with the transition from being on the street into a longer-term housing program. And maybe they sought some type of inpatient support, like behavioral health support in the community. And so that's also a very good thing. All right. So. Regarding access to other programs, resources while they wait, the housing solutions that our sole focus is housing. And so we do provide formal connections to managed care organizations because they provide case management to folks. We provide formal referrals to the YWCA if someone's a domestic violence survivor, and particularly if they're actively fleeing domestic violence. We have work source staff that are in our office every week, and so we'll connect those who are seeking employment or even just talking about wanting to get their resume together. We also provide formal connections to Lighthouse Resource Center to help decrease debt that they might have. And then we also provide lots and lots of referrals. So we know the community resources. We do a lot of referrals to CVAB, to go and visit at the Center for Community Health or to their warm line, a lot of referrals to Lifeline and Community Services Northwest and Columbia River if someone's interested in behavioral health support, and CMAR if they're interested in physical health support. And so any ongoing program isn't something that we can offer, but when we're working with the client and we're doing an assessment or connecting folks with some other type of resource, will help to triage different resources in the community. The unfortunate reality is we don't have the capacity to serve as a case manager. We can't kind of follow someone ongoing.
Okay, do you have mobile transportation for individuals in pressing need?
don't know. We have our staff who will often bring people to us or give us a heads up, and the outreach staff themselves can do assessments, some of them, and we go out also. And then we have the satellite offices. And then if someone can get to us, we do sometimes have bus passes that we can provide for folks to get back, you know, or to the navigation center.
Okay, that's helpful. Because we hope between 50 to 100 unless it's individual each day. And I know with at least 2 to 3 severe open labels each day that are incomplete. They're not in shelter behavior. Sometimes they're completely uncoachable. So I have calls that have been calling on behalf of our clients a few times. And so it was surprising to hear that their data was already collected and they knew exactly what the last name was. My question is, when they are severely disabled, what would you recommend that we do? Because they obviously do need a case where they need housing. What's the next step for them?
So the reality is that as a community, we do not, within kind of the homeless system, have case managers who can follow folks. And that's the unfortunate difficulty. If someone engages with a managed care organization, particularly if they have Molina, then they have case managers who can help. And then the other piece is just checking in to see if they have connected with the Housing Solutions Center. And if that's the case, then we definitely have their info. And then outreach, I know you know the outreach teams too. But the fact is that we do not have nearly the resources, again, to be able to move folks not only from the street to permanent stable housing, but we also don't have like case management staffing or navigation staffing. We have basically 6 outreach staff for the entire county. And there's a lot of other grassroots outreach as well as some behavioral health specific outreach. But when it comes to just homeless outreach, there's not a lot of it. And again, it comes down to having finite resources and the fact that our population of people who are experiencing homelessness continues to grow. And the longer that someone spends on the street, the more any type of mental health symptoms that they might have are exacerbated. And so that's a real enormous challenge. The day center, the navigation center through SHARE is a good place for people to be, a safe place. So that's another connection point. Let's skip through this. No, won't let me. So,
you want me to press the keyboard?
Sure.
See if that works.
So what this is just a snapshot in time, I'll wait for a second, of the number of people that are on our priority pools. And I want to really enhance that this is one snapshot in time. And that on a daily basis, we likely have 6 to 8 households that are added onto a priority pool. And when people are taken off the priority pool, it's all dependent on housing programs. And our goal is not to have as many people as possible. Our goal is to have those that have the highest needs. And unfortunately, we're seeing more and more people that have very high needs in the community. With the VAT, again, those are the folks who have the very highest needs. And so we continue to add to the number of folks who have the VAT. We only have one program for families and permanent supportive housing, which is why there's so few, is because if we can house families that present very high needs through the either permanent supported housing programs or wraparound housing, we'll do that besides putting them on the VAT list. Go ahead.
Can I ask
this
question?
No.
Yep.
So these are people who have housing, or that's the size of the pool who want
the size of the who want the housing.
So while they're on the pool, given that they're really high need, do we do anything?
Yeah. The homeless doesn't get it. No. We work hard to try to connect folks in the best way we can, but again, we can't provide case management.
And that's not like we're choosing not to. I mean,
no.
Yeah, like there isn't capacity to do anything beyond that.
So, regarding connections, when we refer a household to Impact Northwest, for example, We will provide a full file to that agency of all the information that we have, as well as a checklist of what they've asked for from us for a complete file. And on the bottom, there's a signature line. And so we ask for each agency to sign that they've accepted the referral and get it back to us. And so we know that that pathway has been cleared once we get it back. So, in HMIS, we have all the providers that the CAB funds entering data right now. And so if someone touched one of the programs that the CAB funded or another homeless-focused program, then we know if they've engaged. However, for example, most of the food banks don't enter information in HMIS. The behavioral health providers outside of their housing programs don't enter data into HMIS. And so we have a limited view on the number of touches. The reality is that overall, the number of touches are dependent on the length of time that you're looking for. We have a few folks who not only touched the system in 2001 when it started up in the community, when they were kids, but now have come back and touched the system in 2011 and then again in 2018 and 2019 as adults with their own kids. And so that's one thing we can look at, and we do. Generational homelessness is very real in this community, as well as we look closely at which programs someone has engaged with in the past, because that's really indicative of whether they're going to be successful in another program. And so if we're looking at someone who has high needs and they've already engaged with agency A, then we'll check in with them to see if they want to again and remind them that they received services, because they might want to be engaged with another agency.
So we have scheduled the meeting to go until 11, so I wanted to be cognizant of your guys' time. We have a room for a while, so we can stay if you're interested, but I just wanted to check in with you guys before going. Are we okay to keep going?
Yeah,
I'm
okay.
So we do a number of analyses, one being around the system performance measures. Both HUD and the state have very specific measures that the system needs to look at. It includes the length of time that a household is experiencing homelessness. It includes the number of people that are entering into a housing program that serve people experiencing homelessness, the number of people that are exiting a housing program in a positive versus a negative way, and the number of people who are reusing the system within a two-year period. And so those are key outcomes that we continue to pay very close attention to. The number of positive exits went up quite a bit in 2018, which is great. The challenge is that the number of those who are coming back to the system because their stable housing situation became unstable also increased. And when we talk to folks, the number one reason is that they were stable with rent amount A, and then the landlord increased it by $200 or $400, then they weren't stable. And so looking at how we can help ensure that if someone has received assistance through the homeless system, that they continue to remain housed. And that would be a component of prevention assistance. So this is one example of a homeless system map that has been done and that we're working with. I know it's really teeny tiny, but what's nice is that you can see what is the number of people who are exiting emergency shelter in a positive versus a negative way, number of people who are exiting transitional housing, the number of people who are exiting permanent versus wraparound housing. And so there's a number of ways to look at the crisis response system. And right now we're working on a dashboard that will allow us to look at system
systematic system performance measures on a system level, but also on an agency and a program level for our housing programs to be able to better understand, like, you know, what's going on, what isn't.
Do we get to see that?
You, like you as a CAD?
Yeah. It's really
interesting.
This is the first time I've seen.
Well, so yes, I'll tell you, yes, you do. You see it in different formats. So, you know, my honest answer is, I don't know that you recognize what you're seeing, and when you are seeing it, you are getting the information, and we're totally open to changing what you see and what is presented and the frequency of what is presented. Now, understand, our staff time is spent supporting, just like you guys ask us, or ask the service providers, are you spending your time supporting the person in front of you? Our focus is supporting our service providers in doing their job and supporting the CAB, and I just try to have our staff maintain a balance between both.
One of my goals with the new contract, that will be starting in July, is to revamp your guys' quarterly report so it's not just a list of all the programs and this, specific to them, but to include those system level performance measures that we are working towards so that we can provide, so we'll be providing that specific information to you also.
I get what you're saying. I don't want us to.
Oh, I'm not hearing it.
But maybe it's my brain visually, I can see a system here.
Okay.
And I don't understand why it would take staff work to share something that exists. So, but maybe it's confidential.
We're talking aggregate data.
Yeah.
What I will tell you is right now, there isn't an automated dashboard. That's part of what we're talking about being created. So that was actually the product of the Corporation for Supportive Housing that the VHA, brought in, and they did like a 3-week study to produce that.
Okay.
Okay.
I get it.
And we're not in the let me push a button, here you go, CAB, here's the report. The reality is right now, any information we're getting you on a quarterly basis usually involves some staff time in terms of analysis and also some staff time from the Council for the Homeless when we get information like that.
This is
from
what we get from our programs.
Yeah.
And there's a whole lot of data on here that we do collect, but this is what we are getting from them, and then I'm taking that, and Janet's helping take that information to put it into that quarterly report for what we're getting now. But I do totally intend on revamping your quarterly report that will include more of a system level rather than getting into each individual program, so that you'll see a lot of that system level where we're moving as a system.
Thank you. You're being very gracious.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, it's fine.
But
they're good questions.
If you're designing that, let's have a feedback process, because I don't want you to go to a bunch of work and then us say, I don't like this or that. Yeah. So you don't have to reinvent by yourself. We can probably do that in any way we can. So
then the last few questions just regarding diagrams. And I think that the reality is that there's a number of things that are in play. So in the next year, you should see more diagramming of things in general. Regarding beefing up services, I think the reality with the entire homeless crisis response system is that there's an opportunity to increase resources across every single intervention that the system has that exists. And the challenge, of course, is just limited resources and also working to engage the outside resources within the system. For example, if someone comes to me and say, they want to start just giving dollars, $500 to people
the reality is that if it's not approached systemically, where you know there's some type of a process and we can understand who a program is looking to serve, it's very difficult to then be able to see what a difference that program is making in the community, and for us to know whether someone has actually achieved housing stability as a result of engaging with any type of resources. So anytime I meet a new agency or entity, I work to try to bring them into the Housing Solutions Center. Family Promise, which is a new shelter out in Camas, is a good example of that, where we're providing referrals through the housing hotline to that facility so that they have still one place to call the hotline to engage with their shelter beds, as well as know where to engage for longer-term housing options. So regarding a survey, I guess what I'll say regarding that is any type of official documentation that goes to someone's home that is low income, history and experience tells me that they very rarely open it and very rarely engage with it. And that, you know, that's just my experience, my agency's experience. I was just talking to the city of Vancouver, and they said they sent out surveys to all of their TDRA clients, and that they got less than 5% back. So I think the bigger piece is really looking at, you know, who are being served through the different programs, and what's the best way to garner feedback. And oftentimes it's conversation, as well as going to people who are well connected with those, for example, who are experiencing homelessness or those who are living in the shelter, and asking them to garner feedback. And that then creates a much more safe space where someone can share what they're thinking and then ask other questions that they might have. Those are all the questions
that were submitted.
Any others?
I just want to say thank you.
Sure, you're welcome.
For going through, I think that Housing Solutions Center has been with the box. So it's incredibly important that it helps know how information works through it. And one of the things I'd like to say is we're plenty short of resources for health services. We are not always asking for more resources. And I think
that's not true. Let me just, not seriously, like, let me push back on that. We are constantly, as a county, asking for more resources, and you know, from Commerce in terms of CHG, in terms of Penn, you know, there are opportunities, which I think is where you're going, in terms of what advocacy happens. You know, for example, Penn. You know, that we're getting, I think right now it looks, we're not getting, we don't know how much we're getting, but you know, right now legislation, what was assessed to be needed was $69 million to go further in meeting the need based on expansion of eligibility. Based on the budgetary constraints and legislation right now, it's around 16. It'll probably go down to about $12 million, increasing what it currently is. We're going to get some of that. So there are opportunities to ask for more.
I phrased it wrong. I appreciate that the county and the staff and the agency are doing all they can to increase that. I think there's a real increase in motivation by the community to help to solve the problem. I mean, that's the Alice Dying video thing. On Next Door, I mean, it's an hour long, and a lot of people watched it. And Next Door, which is not typically a
Yeah, but in fact, we're sponsoring it.
I think that getting a sense of the community, that the community right now thinks that we're on a tipping point, if you like, on solving the problem. And there is no one solution, I know that. But they're generating more support and acceptance of investments in that.
Taking the information that we're providing for you as a CAB member to go back and say, we don't have the resources, we're only serving 10% of the people that are trying to access services, or 40% of the people trying to access shelter. Providing that education is great advocacy work.
I guess I'll throw out that we ask for additional dollars every day. Both from the city of Vancouver, Clark County, the fact is the approach needs to be different, and from the state, from the feds. I was just talking to Jamie Herrera's Butler's office last week, and there's always opportunity to do just that.
And I think it's the community, they know we're going to ask.
Well, you know, I'll share with you, and the reason I push back on you is I don't want you to think that the asks are not happening. I know, you know, Kate's working on the COC application, we're working on the CHG application right now. There is a lot of narrative out there, you know, of the county's not doing anything.
Yeah.
Okay? And, you know, the fact is, every single thing that happens around homelessness, whether you've just gone through two days of solid presentations, every single service that happens around homelessness, the county has a pretty significant role in, and it's in partnership in a systemic way with all the service providers. There is not a service provider that's doing something. And, you know, that is what the city of Vancouver, the county, the community is doing about homelessness. And the key is, yes, we need to do it in a systemic way. You know, the asks need to be, you know, legislative advocacy. Asks to community organizations and foundations of what can they do to step up and change the role of how they step up in a systemic way, you know, as opposed to assume that nothing's happening and how do we zoom into like a micro activity that's disconnected and let's fund that, you know, whether we're talking a sanctioned encampment somewhere or tiny houses here or there, you know, as opposed to how are we ending homelessness, you know, on a community level, you know.
Sometimes it's such a big issue, it becomes paralytic.
There are advocacy groups out there that actually help with that, to educate the community around that. I hear you saying you're having concern the community itself is not, maybe they're not aware, involved, or invested as much. Is that what I hear you saying? Did you feel that way? So like Rebecca said, we could take the knowledge that we have, I think, and
I'd like to see some support. I mean, we're talking about it in the advocacy committee, and I know that we're doing it on a certain level. We're participating in, you know, this trips to Olympia and things like that. But I totally understand what you're saying, because this has been part of my mission for the last 5 years. And if I look back 5 years ago, there's a huge difference in the system from 5 years ago to now. There's been so many changes and so many increases, but we're just barely stemming the tide. And so really doing a massive sort of campaign towards changing perception, getting all these more people, more community, more neighborhoods on the same page, I think, is a systemic attack on you know, getting support, bringing more people in line, and because that's how big changes are made. I think that the few people that were talking about it were going in circles. I don't know if we know exactly how to go about doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we could get some more support, maybe some input, maybe some, I don't know. I'm not sure what that looks like. But
so you're talking about community awareness in general?
Yes. I mean, really just maybe it's going to neighborhood association meetings and really, you know, presentation. I think having some kind of help putting a presentation together that really changes, you know, the thing about the zip codes, trash, you know, people dying. I don't know what that looks like yet, but I'm seeing an area where this, you know, really needs, we need more community awareness and involvement. And I'm hearing this and I'm seeing it, and that is a systemic approach. So.
Yeah.
I don't have the answer, but
that
I have
is an idea.
I'll be part of the solution.
And so I guess what I'll say is let me throw myself out there as a part of this conversation, because we've been focusing on neighborhood associations, for example, for the last year, and I think there's like 52 of them, and we've met to about 30 of them to do like similar presentations. And so I'm glad to have conversations where, you know, either the current, we have an entire education series that we've planned out for the rest of the year around best practices and advocacy and things like that. And I know you've been very involved. But like, how can we like collaborate on something like that, which I think will only just raise both the systemic focus as well as our ability to use our voices.
Because I think different voices and additional people and different organizations, the more we collaborate, the better.
Mm-hmm. And then if I can just encourage the continuum of care, so the Coalition of Service Providers meeting is definitely an opportunity to get more involved with what's happening systemically.
That was yesterday.
There's one next month, the second Wednesday at the YWCA, 10 a.m.
Because I sat there yesterday and went, damn, I meant to go to that meeting.
Oh.
Yeah, no, okay. This is the second Wednesday of odd number
of months.
I would like to.
So in the recovery community, we just hold a huge event once a year, and then to help the community become aware of it. It's called Hands Across Grace.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we do a lot of those things. So, and I'm not saying, it's taken care of, because those things are happening. You know, I guess I'd really encourage, so yes, to what you're saying, we need more grassroots engagement, not grassroots engagement to government, local government, to then engage in community neighborhoods. We need more grassroots engagement directly with other grassroots organizations and build that community capacity and awareness and stuff. You know, I also hear from the CAB specifically a lot of frustration of, like, we're rubber stamped, or, hey, we're stopping you from doing stuff. And please understand, it's not that we don't think these are problems, so the CAB should not be involved. Is really, the CAB has a very specific role that is, look at the bylaws, look at the charter, and that's what the CAB is there for. And it's really there to continue funding and to assist with the funding of the Community Services Block Grant, ultimately. We the county is using the CAB as a citizen advisory board to provide some community input to a lot of these other funding sources. But what's made the CAB necessary is the legislation around Community Services Block Grant, what I would really say is the role that the CAB has around funding all these funding sources that you're evaluating is hugely important. The ranking and prioritization is meaningful, and it's incredibly important every year, every 3 years, throughout the periodicity. When you want to get
more involved in specific issues, you know, outside of what we're trying to do and what we have to do around the funding, do it. I really encourage you to do it. It's not that, like, you know, that, you know, don't do it, Cab. It's not a problem in the community. Is look at where it's already happening. So, like, if it's homelessness, what are the organizations that are doing the homeless advocacy, the community engagement, and engage through that. You know, if we're talking food insecurity, if you're talking, you know, like, really, plug in and do the energies, you know, around that. What, as a county process, we're going to be involved with the CAB, outside of the advocacy task force and legislative advocacy, it's really going to be focused on funding these systemic approaches based on best practices, you know. Because what we're dealing with are those public service dollars that are community resources that have to, you know, it is our ethical obligation that they go into services and that those services in the community are done in the most systemic, efficient way possible. You know, so that's, you know, in terms of where our local government focus is, and as a CAB, where, you know, you intersect in purposes, that's what our purpose is.
We also have, as part of our vision, to build the system.
Absolutely.
As far as including the community, we have a responsibility to the community, and I know you obviously, you're not a seeding innovation, that's not our role, but I think it's beyond the funding we have. If we look at system, then there's a whole bunch of little pieces who we don't fund, but who are part of the system, and that we have not a responsibility, but we can take on the task of growing them, supporting them, and understanding where the gaps are.
Sure. Remember, our public dollars are going to go to services, you know, public services. And in a systemic way. So in terms of organizational capacity building of other organizations, that's important. That's a worthy goal. It is within a realm of advocacy. You know, it's just not going to be the funding piece.
Anyway,
yeah, but thank you.
No, this is fine.